And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, whichever the case may be around this rotating globe, wherever you are. Welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight, which as the times around us and the events around us get crazier and crazier and crazier, are trying to probe beyond the edge of the radar to see what might be coming and what events are, shall we say, giving us some forward-thinking clues. Tonight we're doing a part two of the show that we, because of one of my guests had some issues that we couldn't bring him on last night. We're going to do part two, what we started out to do last weekend and then replayed last night. The Didymos story, the Dimorpho story, the DART impact mission story, because in the last 3 weeks, it's actually 3 weeks, not 2 weeks, which I wrote in the promo. It's amazing how time flies when you're not having fun. There have been some really interesting developments. And what we're going to try to do tonight is to track on two stories that are co-mingled in terms of the DART asteroid redirect saga. But before we get to that, I want to do a couple of news items at the top, like we usually do. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, if you're new to the show, that's our URL, theothersideofmidnight.com. That will take you to our homepage. Click on tonight's banner, which says rather dramatically, and believe me, there is data to back this up, unknown ships are hanging half a mile off the park bow, the continuing saga of the DART asteroid impact mission. So you click on that banner, that will take you to the guest page, and right under the guest page, you will see where it says fast links to items. Click on my name, and that will take you to the section of radio with pictures where we have news. And item number one, after a number of stops and starts and a hurricane and rolling the stack back to the vehicle assembly building, NASA has now set another date for their next launch attempt of the unmanned Artemis 1 test mission. Item number two, or Artemis 2, which will be in a couple of years, will take a crew around the moon. And then sometime after that, another year or so, it will take a crew to a landing on the moon at the South Pole. But this first new launch attempt of Artemis 1 is to send the unmanned spacecraft on a long looping trajectory, which now it turns out because of the delayed launch date, mid-November, November 14th, and I'll get to the details of that in a minute. They will only have about a 25-day mission orbiting the moon before they return. Now, this is kind of interesting because one of the objectives of Artemis was to kind of really stress every aspect of the spacecraft and the system and the management and the operations and all the things that go into, you know, taking people back to the moon. And their original plan was to have a mission that was something like 42 days in length, which is roughly twice the amount of time that the Orion spacecraft can survive with consumables and power and all that in orbit without getting back to Earth. Because of the late launch date and the way the celestial mechanics of the moon orbiting the Earth and the Earth orbiting the sun, and the fact that you cannot have an eclipse of the spacecraft en route to the moon or coming back from the moon more than 90 minutes, the way all those celestial factors line up, turns out that the new mission for Artemis, Artemis 1, launching on the 14th in the wee hours of the 14th, will be only 25 days, which is not really the thorough ring-out period that we had in hearing about. And I'm going to be very interested to hear some of my old friends, including Bill Harwood at CBS, ask the NASA mission managers, how did you wind up cutting about half the time of the extended mission that would really ring out the onboard systems on the Orion spacecraft? And I'll be really intrigued with their answers because we could delay it even further and then get back to a longer mission window. But for some reason, They're wanting to go on the 14th. Now, hearken back to what I said several weeks ago, which was I kept seeing these repeated stops and starts as a plausible way to delay the Artemis mission overall. Why delay? Because when it gets there, when it gets to the moon with all these incredible high-tech, state-of-the-art HD television cameras, there's no way, if they give us live uncensored television, that anybody's going to be able to miss the damn ruins on the moon. So is it possible that all these delays have been built in so that they only get there after the capstone mission, which is supposed to arrive on the 13th, is in lunar orbit, and the Denuri mission is less than 3 weeks away coming along behind? In other words, does capstone and Artemis have to be there essentially simultaneously for one to corroborate the other? And is this part of the hidden mission plan? I can't answer that tonight. You know, it's like we're trying to piece together all the stuff from outside. There's nobody on the inside at the moment leaking. So we basically have to do it by the numbers and look at the overall mission plans and see where things are congruent and where they're contradictory. And, you know, it's kind of like the old checks and balances game. So you have to kind of figure out by the consistencies, or in this case, the inconsistencies, what's really going on. In terms of this show, it makes for that night very, very interesting radio. Because as I was telling some of our folks just before airtime, it turns out they're going to try to launch Artemis 1 on this unmanned 25-day mission on the night of the 13th, the morning of the 14th. The launch time on the East Coast time, will be 12:07 a.m. on the morning of the 14th, which, of course, is still Sunday night here in New Mexico, and our show goes on the air at 10 Mountain Time, which is midnight Eastern Time, which is 7 minutes before the launch, T-minus zero. So we will know in the count leading up to launch, by the time we come on the air that night, whether there's going to be a live mission attempt down to the last few minutes of the what they call the terminal count, or whether they have some other problem which crops up with probably hydrogen and fueling and quick disconnects and all that, and they're going to wave off. So by the time we come on the air that night, I'll be able to say at the top of the show either the countdown is in progress, in which case we will go to the Cape live and we'll track through the interesting events of getting this thing off the ground, or I will come on and I will say, no, there has been another wave off and they are working on a rescheduled date. So that will be the middle of November, which is about a month from tonight. Item number two, remember there's more than one horse in this return to the moon horse race. There's the NASA Artemis program, which of course is run by the U.S. government, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And as part of the Artemis program, there are government components, which is the SLS, the Space Launch System. There is the Orion spacecraft, which is built by Lockheed Martin. Boeing. There is the service module, which is built by the European Space Agency. And in terms of mission number three, which will be the first effort by Artemis to land human beings, Americans, again on the moon, targeted now for 2025, Elon Musk is in the mix because NASA gave him a contract to create the lunar lander that will take the crew from lunar orbit in their Artemis Orion spacecraft down to the moon's surface, and that's going to be one of his variants of the so-called Starship. Well, apropos of that, this past week, the world's first civilian space tourist, an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley who made, you know, mucho bucks doing computer stuff, Dennis Tito, who, remember, bought for $20 million plus a private tourist flight to the International Space Station some years ago to the Russian segment, he has now signed up for an unknown amount of money to SpaceX to be the second tourist flight or on the second tourist flight around the moon sometime after the Artemis 3 landing. And that opens up all kinds of things. It's going to be him, his wife, and 10 other tourists on this second flight. As you know, the first flight of tourists under Musk's guidance will be a Japanese billionaire and an unknown number and population of other tourists who are going to be paying their own way to take their first journey around the moon. Again, this is extraordinarily opening and democratic because all of these folks with all those eyeballs and all those cameras and all those binoculars and all those means of high-tech digital recording, there's no way they cannot see from a 125-mile orbit around the moon, which is what that story number two specifically describes for Dennis Tito's flight. There's no way they can't see the ruins, particularly on the far side of the moon, which is much better preserved than the near side. This is all auguring remarkable things in terms of a transformation of human consciousness as to who we are, what we're all doing in this place, what our real history has been, you know, what has been suppressed for, you know, half a century ever since NASA started going to the moon, even before that with unmanned missions. It's all going to hit the proverbial rotating kitchen appliance in the next few years, if not the next few weeks. If, in fact, the imagery from Capstone and Denuri and Artemis 1 of the moon, the close-ups of the moon, are honest and uncensored, which in this day and age when anybody for $30 million can send a private mission to orbit the moon is kind of probably in the cards. It's not going to be possible for these guys to keep everything kind of on the QT for very much longer, which means we are about to undergo the most extraordinary expansion of human consciousness, certainly in our lifetimes, probably in the lifetime of the human species here on Earth, since way back when things began in a very non-historical fashion, contrary to the history which we have been fed. On that note, item number three, and this, of course, is the substance now of what we're going to be talking about tonight. NASA did something 3 weeks ago which had two dramatic effects. And so we're going to be talking with our guests and panelists tonight about both of these effects. One is they slammed a spacecraft into this asteroid orbiting a much bigger asteroid about 7 million miles away from Earth the night of the impact, and it had spectacular effects. I mean, really spectacular effects, which according to the agency itself were totally unmodeled. It exceeded all their expectations, and we'll be going through the details momentarily. If you look at item number three, this is video put together from the still images that were taken by the Italian little sub-satellite that the DART spacecraft kind of tossed out the trunk several days before their own impact. And it was a little CubeSat with its own independent solar power and batteries and cameras and radios and control and all that. And it took pictures from a standoff distance of the impact. It then flew by itself a few minutes later and then continued on looking backward, taking lots and lots of pictures as it receded from the site of the impact. And they've been downlinking at literally phone-in, you know, dial-up rates because of the limited radio bandwidth on this little CubeSat. For the last several weeks, they've been basically sending down to Earth the remarkable sequence of imagery. So what we're seeing is only a few frames will ultimately, I think, be composited into a smooth, high motion, high resolution video sequence. So we'll see from before impact and then after impact and then way after impact and we can square that from different angles of looking at the post-impact system from the Earth, from Earth observatories, and all of that will kind of fill in many of the gaps now in the official story. So without further ado, why don't I introduce my guest tonight? Because for that, you want to go back up to the banner on the guest page and click on where it says Fast Links to Bios. We've got Andrew Curry with us, who is, as you know, a storyboard artist. He's worked in murals in schools, community centers. He's a graphic designer. He works in Hollywood. He works for large and small Canadian companies in television and film and commercial TV advertising. And he has a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of British Columbia. So, Andrew, welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for having us again and having me.
Okay. We've also got Robert Morningstar with us from New York City. Robert has a remarkable background. He's a specialist in photo interpretation, geometric analysis, computer imaging. He's a graduate of the Power Memorial Academy and was a regional state scholar at Fordham University, where he received a degree in psychology. And while at Fordham in 69, he participated as a research fellow in a U.S. Navy-sponsored program to develop artificial intelligence. He's an expert in Chinese. He's an FAA-licensed private pilot with some remarkable stories there. He's also the current publisher and editor of the UFO Spotlight and UFO Digest. And he's basically a civilian space intelligence analyst. So without further ado, Robert, welcome back also to The Other Side of Midnight.
Thank you, Richard. Great to be here. Looking forward.
Okay. Well, we have a lot to get to, including some really interesting new stuff at the South Pole, which oddly enough connects to our conversation regarding Didymos tonight. Do we have Ron with us yet, Keith?
Oh, yes.
There you are. Ron Gerbron is our resident uncredentialed polymath. Those are his words. He's really a generalist.
Okay, no word.
He's really a generalist, and he knows a bit about an awful lot of stuff, including extraterrestrial archaeology, and he's therefore one of the very few experts in this field anywhere on the planet except for those in the deep black, deep state government occupations who, of course, never appear on television or radio or write blogs or send tweets or whatever. So, and we've got Keith Morgan with us, who, of course, will have some interesting ideas from time to time. Let's see. Let me start with you, Andrew. It's been now 3 weeks. Why don't we begin with what new stuff you have learned about the DART mission?
Sure. Do you want to go to my items?
That's a good idea.
Okay. So if we go to the show banner. Everybody, well, if you're new to the show, what you do is you go to the show banner. Go to theothersideofmidnight.com. The show banner will come up, and the show banner tonight says, Richard, what does it say? I'm going to go back to it. Unknown ships are hanging half a mile off the port bow. So it's us, the EM imaging team. You tap on that, and you'll find our fast link. So mine is under Andrew, and I've got just a couple tonight. Now, so my impetus for tonight, Richard, was something that you said this past week. So, folks, we have a lot of back channels. Those that listen a lot will know this, either on the phone or sharing emails and then fighting and then agreeing and making up and everything else we do. But this new image, and if we click on my number one, this is a image from – Richard, do you want to describe it? This is NASA.
Okay, this is an official NASA picture from the mission, and what I did was to kind of tinker with it and do some compositing so we see into the shadows. It was recomposited by a citizen scientist named Roman Tishenko, who does some really good work. And so after I did some tinkering, we brightened it up so you can see into the shadows, and you'll see there at the top of the large object on the right, which is Didymos, which is supposed to be half a mile in diameter. And then on the left is Dimorphos, which is supposed to be around 600 feet in diameter. You can see into the shadowing near the so-called North Pole, there's all kinds of lattice work and geometry and lacy geometric structures that should not be on a natural asteroid. And then around the edge, around the limb, you can see this scattering of smaller points of light that appear to be semi-regularly spaced, like there's also more geometry that is above the surface that we're seeing, but has long since eroded away. So we're only seeing a fraction of what used to be there. And it was Tyshenko's really excellent processing that allowed me to bring out some of these details. So I kicked it over to Andrew and I said, what do you think of this? And Andrew,
well, you
go ahead.
You said that, and then you also said, oh my gosh, it looks like a battle wagon. And I was like, oh my gosh. And immediately, and Richard, you want to describe for those that are, you know, maybe on our younger side, what a battle wagon means?
Well, it's a term that came from between the wars, actually pre-World War I, when Teddy Roosevelt, you know, sent the Great White Fleet around the world. And back then, the capital ships, the big ships that nations were using to square off against one another were dreadnoughts and or i.e. battleships. And the slang name for the battleships was battle wagons. So I just had this kind of gut visceral impression that what we're seeing in Didymos close up is the geometry of artificiality, incredible erosion, parts of it eaten away so we can see the geometric interior. We can even see the kind of depth of the shell of artificiality around this former object, which I think was a real asteroid, because what better way to live in space than to basically build a whole bunch of stuff on a big asteroid that you then can mine under your feet for resources like water, oxygen, nitrogen, you know, various other chemical compounds, minerals. You can, you know, go distill them. You can make stuff out of them. In other words, it becomes your own source of resources as an independent, maybe battle wagon is not the right term, but I got that feeling because remember, in our model, the reason we're seeing any of this stuff is there was a great, great war in the ancient solar system. And if you have a war, you've got to have opposing military forces. And those would have been in space, and they would have been whatever the era would then call battle wagons. So that's just kind of my visceral impression. So that's what I said to Andrew.
Yeah, and then I immediately thought of the original 1978 TV series. It began, I think, as a movie, came out in the theaters at first, Battlestar Galactica, Glenn A. Larson, I believe.
Yep, I was just going to say, Glenn Larson.
Yeah, and I found a still from the show. And then if you're hearing a howling, I don't know if you can hear that, guys, but that's my son who's about to go to bed, and he's howling through the walls to try to get me to come up. So excuse that for a moment. I'm being a bit distracted. So I got a still from the Battlestar Galactica show, and I actually reversed it because it's in the opposite direction. And it, Richard, it just reminded me of this shot of the great fleet that was, you know, the ragtag fleet that was being, you know, headed and rescued by Battlestar Galactica. You know, a science fiction show, but very, very interesting. And the same sort of paneling that this model, because it's a model, it was a real model. They didn't have the digital effects back then that they do now. And those panels on the Battlestar just immediately reminded me of Didymos. And not only that, but Didymos has like a knob right at the perfect, like at the apex point. So mm-hmm. if we come out of that, yeah, we
well,
come
look,
out of that.
Look, look at all that symmetry. It's like we're looking kind of catty corner at the front, which is backward. In other words, the spacecraft is moving around the sun to the upper right, but Dimorphos, which is a big object to the left, is coming around toward the spacecraft, and the spacecraft is moving toward it in a counterclockwise orbit. And so you've got the mothership, and then you've got this thing orbiting about half a mile away, and we smashed into with DART the smaller thing on the left. And I don't know how much is left of it. I have a feeling there isn't very much left given the extraordinary energies that we saw. But to me, it's the eroded but obvious symmetries and geometry of Didymos on the right-hand side that say overwhelmingly, if you know what you're looking at, this is not a natural object. This is artificially reordered, redone, re-engineered.
Yeah, yeah. And if we come out of my number one, then we'll skip. Oops, we'll skip past my number two just for the moment, and go to number three. This one's called Didymos Battle Wagon Enhanced. Again, we're using it as a term just to kind of ground us in the idea of artificiality. It's not necessarily it was a battleship. And what I did is I just did a quick illustration just to kind of
empathize. Oh, my God, look at that.
Yeah, Richard, there's like an apex nodule capstone type of end to this thing. It's got panels just like Battlestar Galactica, you know, front hull. And I didn't have a chance to look really close at the lattice work, but you're absolutely correct that there is repeating geometry and symmetry all over this thing, and you can see the eroding decks. If you put it really big on your computer screen and turn the lights out in your room and stand back a couple of feet, you'll see all this stuff pop out. Just do like widescreen on it.
The problem is we're all used to seeing brand new stuff. We don't live in a culture where there's lots of ruins unless you live in Watts or Harlem or someplace like that. And so the idea, the art form of looking at ancient eroded stuff and looking through the erosion at the underlying symmetry and order and organization and design elements, it, you know, as the Boeing study said, there's about a third of the population that can do this just in their head. There's a third that can be taught, and there's about a third that can never see this stuff. So for the two-thirds who can see this, you know, welcome to the club. And for the third that can't, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, what's his name in the A-Team? Pity the poor people who can't see it, because it's stunning. And it has such extraordinary implications for the origin and destiny of all the rest of us, i.e. human beings, in the 21st century here on planet Earth.
Mr. T.
Absolutely. Now, I know we're about to
Mr. T.
Break.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Ron. Yeah.
I know we're
coming
like to
It looks like a coconut, by the way.
Well, Ron, if we come out of that and go to my number two, and I'd really like Richard to kind of talk about this, because it's the model. It's the model of this thing, this repeating diamond-y shaped model that we've been talking about that is absolutely extraordinary. Do you want to talk about it quickly, Richard? Just tell people
what
this
is. Well, this is a time sequence video composed obviously of individual frames taken recently by Mars Express, which is still orbiting Mars, went into orbit around 2003. It's still there. It's in this very long looping orbit that takes it about 10,000 miles away and then well inside the orbit of the inner Martian moon Phobos, which is 6,000 miles above the surface. And what they did is they videoed a sequence by stills of Deimos, which is the outer moon, the two moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos. The outer moon is around 30,000 miles away. And from their inner orbit, Mars Express looked at Deimos as it tracked in its orbit around Mars with Jupiter, with its four moons in the background, about half a billion miles further away from the sun than Mars is. And what's interesting is because you're in the equatorial plane of Deimos, you can really see this truncated octahedral or truncated diamond shape. And when we flew by an asteroid some years ago, when I say we, the human race, it was the Europeans that did it, en route to 67P with the Dawn spacecraft, they flew by an asteroid
4
miles across named Steins, thank you. And that spacecraft turned out to be of a diamond shape. Well, it turns out that all of these seem to have a kind of a common model form, kind of like Chevys and Olds and Cadillacs and whatever, and they're different sizes, but they're in fact all of the same basic geometry, and that, I think, is a major clue as to who did it, who built these things, and why. And on that note, we're going to stop for a momentary pause here at the bottom of the hour. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, too numerous at the moment to mention, our subject is Didymos and how it could literally change the fate of humankind. We shall return.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night, October 16th, 2022. We're talking about the Didymos mission, or the DART mission to Didymos, the big guy, and Dimorphos, the little guy. And Ron can tell you about the background mythology of their naming. And we're talking about the fact...
If you like.
Well, we'll get to that, yeah.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is the idea that NASA did something which I'm not sure how much of NASA really knew beforehand what they were going to do. I suspect there's a lot of people now asking a lot of questions inside because the results they got were so off the wall, so beyond the various models that nobody could kind of ignore what happened, which was wildly beyond most, if not all, of their expectations. So let me return to Andrew's subject with the video that he put up, because, as I said, a few days ago, the Mars Express spacecraft took this series of images composed into a video of Deimos, the outer moon, which is, you know, maybe 8-9 miles across, orbiting Mars at about 30,000 miles distance, in the equatorial plane of Mars itself, and it and Phobos, the inner moon, which is only 6,000 miles up, had this remarkably truncated, agonizingly artificial form, and we've got much better close-up images of Phobos than Deimos, but the overall geometry of all these objects almost looks like there was some plant somewhere that stamped these things out on a variety of scales ranging from miles across to just like 1,300 feet, which is the size, I think, of Ryugu. But they basically all have this same incredibly badly eroded form. And now we've walked up on one which is only half a mile across, and it appears to be some of the best preserved surface detail of any that we have seen. And then the question is that just accidental? Or was that part of the plan, an extraordinarily ancient, millions of years old plan to give the human race a gift, a time capsule from the ancient past, and the human's response was to go out and clobber it, destroy it, blow it to kingdom come, like humans do with a lot of their history.
Gentlemen, hey, Richard.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a detail that I ran across in the tech papers on the asteroid stuff. I think fits in there. They have a lovely catalog at JPL or someplace of the small NEAs, near Earth asteroids like Didymos / Dimorphos, that they are interested in that are binaries. That is just like the one we're looking at here. And there are like 240 of them, something like that, on that list out of a million near-Earth asteroids that they have cataloged. So they've been paying attention to these. And they said they're very
scarce, relatively speaking, and I don't know how they do the percentages because I don't think they have full numbers, of the MBAs or the main belt asteroids, you know, in the asteroid belt. There's some of them scattered around in there, but not very many. But there's one detail that they all have in common, all but a couple of them. They didn't, no place I saw gave me an exact number, but they said, you know, almost all of them. They call them top-shaped, which if you think of a dreidel, you know, the ceremonial top, that kind of top, not the kind of top that it means to me, but they're an oblate spheroid with a equatorial bulge, as they say. And they happen to be within a degree or so of the plane of ecliptic in their orientation. In other words, they're straight up and down relative to the rest of the solar system, just
right.
like the planets are,
right.
which is not typical for just every rock that's tumbling around out there. And, you know, that could be a factor. And those lumps on Ryugu and Bennu, the two that we've gotten the best look at so far, are probably related. It turns out that the large knob, already heard it referenced, that's kind of at the point on both of them, it is about the same. They're both like 600 feet across. In other words, they're both about the same size as Dimorphos.
Actually, I don't think that's correct. I think one is 3,000 feet and the other is around 1,500 feet.
I'm not talking about the whole asteroid, just the bump on it.
Okay.
Just the bump.
Okay.
Yeah, the bump. Yeah,
the fact that they're located at the poles or one of the poles. See, the problem with the dual
yeah.
asteroid model and the idea that when asteroids have little satellites going around, there's some kind of tidal thing going on so the equator bulges out, is that Ryugu
right.
and Bennu are totally solitary asteroids. There are no satellites. Dimorphos and Didymos are unique, not only in the sense of a big guy and a much smaller guy orbiting each other, but the plane crossing Earth exactly so the eclipses and occultations can be seen from Earth, and two, the period. As I said to
mm-hmm.
Robert last week, 11 hours, 55 minutes really caught my attention because it's a whisker away from 12 hours, which is half the diurnal cycle of the Earth. And my feeling is that this was given to us. It was specifically put together as a time capsule for whatever civilization would pick up, you know, the torch millions of years after the horrendous conflict, the Great War, millions of years ago that we've been positing. And it was designed so that we would go there, go inside and find the goodies, find the libraries, find the records, find the video, find our history, find out everything about how we got here, which has nothing to do with the way normal history is written, obviously. And somebody decided to go out and blow the thing away, and I'm just praying that they went and looted it beforehand, the guys in the secret space program, and then turned to NASA and said, okay, you know, it's a free fire zone. Do whatever you will with what you will. That's part one of this idea that we did something to something that's not natural. It's not asteroids. It was two ships or a habitat, a space dock, if you will, and a ship, Dimorphos being the ship. And we just, in our first mission to an asteroid to find out really important stuff, we just banged the hell out of it and changed its orbit from 11 hours, 55 minutes to 11 hours and 23 minutes, shortening its period dramatically, and thereby is the extraordinary data to confirm, in fact, was an artificial object and not an asteroid. And when we get further into my stuff later in the evening, I'll lay out exactly how that all fits together.
Richard, what might be helpful is that those things scattered around in those near Earth orbits, let's hope that that's an outer space Rotterdam, you know, like a ship. What do they call the yards where the ships
dry dock?
Not dry dock. Not dry docks, but where ships go to live out their last rusty years. You know, they just
All the Liberty ships that are anchored in somewhere off where you live, Andrew. in that day between Seattle and Vancouver.
Yeah, Rotterdam is that area, is that harbor in the Netherlands, and it's full of them. And most of them...
There's also one north of San Francisco, if I remember, up by Redmond. Or Richmond.
Oh, sure.
Not Redmond. Richmond.
There's one on the East Coast somewhere, too.
Yeah, but these are not all together. They're all orbiting in separate orbits. So,
my point is that those ships that are sitting in those conditions, most of them don't have anything in the hold to speak of. You know, they've been pretty, not necessarily completely stripped at all, but, you know, emptied out. They don't have leftover photographs and boxes of stuff.
Yeah, but they're left as time capsules.
I know.
The analogy totally breaks down. I'm talking about deliberately done to save part of ancient humanity for future humanity who can reconstruct what really happened and how we really got here.
I'm right there with you. I'm just saying they're probably most of them are empty. So it's a matter of getting lucky. Now, I don't know how they would know that one was one of the ones that...
Well, wait, most of them be empty? If it was the end of a super colossal war that destroyed whole planets, the catastrophe, the disorganization, the panic, the fear, the death of billions of people, God knows how many people died in this war, wouldn't have left anybody any time to do any kind of salvage. So I think what we're seeing are just derelicts orbiting where they were when the great catastrophe happened, and there's incredible stuff in all of them to be gleaned if you go back and rendezvous and go inside and don't destroy them.
Yeah, I'm very opposed to blowing them up before we can look inside. I couldn't
Well, that's
agree
why
more.
I think there's a it would be crazy if there is a space program, which there is, Dorothy. It'd be crazy for our guys not to want to learn as much about this incredibly ancient, sophisticated, hyperdimensional physics and technology as they could before they destroy something. And I think it was a handoff between the secret guys and the public NASA guys, because they had a good use in terms of this planetary defender model, which, of course, if we have a secret space program and we have control of gravity, the whole idea of bumping into stuff with spaceships and knocking them like billiard balls off course is crazy. It's obsolete. It doesn't make any sense. But again, depending upon the compartmentalization between the secret space program and the NASA program, there could well be such ironclad classified barriers that the honest guys are clueless as to what the secret guys really have or are really capable of using. And never the twain shall meet. Robert, you're being awfully quiet.
Yes.
Well, I have this saying that children should be seen and not heard, and adults should be heard and not seen. But I'm just listening to you guys. It's an intriguing theory we have here. I think that we are gathering more and more evidence that our scenario is right, and they blasted a spaceship.
Well,
to Kingdom.
I think I can prove it by the numbers. And someone said to me the other day, "Well, people aren't impressed by numbers," and I went, "What?" Because numbers are the foundation of any science. It was a guy back in the 19th century, Arthur Eddington, who was one of the folks that actually verified first Einstein's relativity, with a huge controversial story attached to that. But Eddington is quoted famously as saying, "Gentlemen, you do not have a science unless you can express it in numbers." Well, NASA, at that press conference last Tuesday, gave us the numbers where I think tonight I can prove beyond a reasonable doubt, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that we actually almost destroyed an ancient spaceship. And it's not complicated numbers. It's incredibly simple numbers. So when we're at that part of the show, I will lay them out, and you may obviously make your own judgments.
Richard, I want to say that I agree with you on that score. But the sad thing is that our nation has been so dumbed down over the last 40 years that almost you might say there's a mathematics priesthood, like they used to talk about the computer priesthood, and they have put it out of reach by dumbing down the people who are graduating from schools, just look at the disastrous results of the most recent SAT scores, the worst in 40 years. So I think that's intentional, and that's a very sad thing. So only people who were well-educated in mathematics and understand numbers. So the great thing about your show is that you make it accessible to the ordinary citizen who's not a mathematical genius.
Well, we can explain this in numbers, and we can also explain it in English. And it doesn't take a person who really is any kind of a math expert to get this. So tonight is kind of like a test. For those people at the end of the show, we will ask for responses. How many understand the incredible breakthrough that NASA gave us, either inadvertently, and because we're dealing with all kinds of dual and triple agendas now, you can never tell the players, even without a scorecard, you can't tell them, because there are like dual agendas, people who are leaking under the pretense that they're not leaking, under the pretense that they're really ignorant, when they really know something is wrong, and they're hoping that somebody outside will come and rescue them with real stuff. I mean, we live in a very complicated time. So,
can I step in here for a minute?
Yeah, by all means.
Oh. Okay, if you look at Andrew's third image, the one of the enhanced rock, if you want to call it, but it's not a rock. Did anybody notice the little protrusion at the bottom in the middle of that thing that looks like an airspeed sensor on a jet?
Yes.
Also, it has the same shape as what? Hey.
It's called a
pitot. Same thing that was on the Tic Tac. Same thing on the Tic Tac. Anybody notice that?
Yeah.
Ooh. Huh. I hadn't.
Well, there's also something on the far left which sticks out, which on a better version of this that I've got actually has some geometric detail. I mean, there's so many geometric things on this. You can't tell what anything is for. You just know it's not natural. It's not a rock. Because look at the scale. If this whole thing is half a mile from the left edge to the where it goes in the shadow on the right, then these things are hundreds of feet across. They're not tiny.
You know, Richard,
by the way, the object that Keith is referring to is called the pitot tube. And I want to talk about something that I've noticed in the original photographs of Dimorphos with regard to the spaceship that Andrew has illustrated. It seems to me, if you look closely at the area that Andrew has highlighted in his drawing and you look under the rubble, it kind of looks like a turtle shell under the rubble, like the spaceship is resting on the object, yet its contours are easily discernible. It's also symmetrical. If you want to talk about it in terms of topography, there's a central valley and there's symmetrical ranges on either side. And I think that I describe it as a turtle shell because it rises above the regular surface of Dimorphos before it was destroyed. And I think we should look more closely at that in the – there are other photographs that are of greater detail.
Robert?
Yes.
Robert, you introduced a magic word, the turtle. It's in mythology – no, I'm serious. In mythology, turtles, which most people paid very little attention to, are often connected with sky events. Now, what would give them the idea about having flying turtles?
Well, flying turtles and flying saucers kind of look alike from a distance. You know, that curvature is...
And the plate.
Yeah, and the plate.
Well, Ron, you remember that Native Americans had a name for a continental United States before the Europeans arrived. They called it Turtle Island.
Yes.
Well... Ever wondered why?
And remember the Hindus' vision of the cosmos.
Oh yes, the turtle standing.
The turtle was carrying everything on its back. The four elephants that held
on.
Up the rest.
Well,
of
all right. If we go back to Van Flandern's model, which is 66 million years ago, where there was a hell of a war using weapons that could destroy whole planets, and then one was blown to kingdom come in the asteroid belt, leaving a huge number of pieces, debris, flying in all kinds of orbits. Most of them escaped. Some of them were trapped by the sun. They're, you know, in the belt. They're in the looping orbits, the Amor and Aton asteroids, et cetera, and the Apollo asteroids, I believe that a later civilization harvesting the resources of the exploded planet, developing its own space program, decided to colonize this destroyed solar system by building on these ancient fragments of the exploded planet, which would have all the resources of the planet was blown to kingdom come, but basically no gravity field. So you could reshape, remodel, drill, mine, in other words, all the stuff we're talking about doing now was done millions of years ago after the big conflagration. And the reason you're seeing this kind of underlying geometry, symmetry, is because these were, like, Deimos is not hollow through and through. Or as I can demonstrate tonight, the Dimorphos was hollow through and through. It was obviously a ship. Deimos is an asteroid with artificial stuff built on top. Most of it now eroded away. That's why we see the geometry in the shadows near the so-called North Pole. But there's so much of it that a lot of it is left. And both objects probably, if they were set up like I think they were, as time capsules, as treasure places for us to go and figure out who the hell we are, both of them were carefully put in orbit around each other as a waiting receptacle for us or our ancestors or our descendants to find, depending upon when we got back to space in a big way again. And as I said, NASA publicly, very dramatically blew this damn thing up.
You know, Richard,
guys, I got to cut in. I'm sorry. This has been like just killing me. So the video that Richard was talking about, folks, Deimos, Richard, when I was watching the video again and you were speaking, the first thing that entered my mind, especially when Ron started the talk, was Rendezvous with Rama and Arthur C. Clarke and the big – it just hit me. And now you guys are coming right to it. And could some of these ancient spaceships, like you say, be turtles or pillars holding up an entire internal world or some sort of garden that's, you know, an inner – I mean, I know this is a crazy –
Well, remember
concept.
One of those epic Star Trek episodes the original Star Trek series, "For the world is hollow – and I have touched the sky." That came directly from an engineer who worked for the General Electric Corporation back in the 1960s, known as Dandridge Cole, who was the first serious scientist engineer to propose very elaborately, including a wonderful coffee table kind of book, that the human race should go out, hollow out asteroids, make them into rotating habitats, spin them for gravity. You would live on the inside. And then ultimately, when technology evolved far enough, think of nuclear physics, nuclear fusion, et cetera, you could send these as seed ships to other star systems with people living for generations off the resources of this massive artificial world that had been hollowed out, that basically you'd be surrounded by resources with proper recycling that you could live for hundreds of generations, if not thousands. Between stars at well below the speed of light.
Richard, this is an intriguing idea that an aggressive race could take the rubble of a planet that they destroyed and create a habitat. And it's interesting, we never talk about a very important heavenly body, or you might call it hellish body, and that's Eris, the planetoid that's the size about the size of Pluto. And Eris in mythology is the goddess of disharmony, and in some people's legends, the wife of Lucifer. And that's something that we should investigate. I discovered it, studying, Starry Night Backyard years ago. I just hit it, and I looked at it and said, thank God, that looks like a planet. It's a small planetoid. We should do a show on Eris and investigate that thing, because it could be the object that you're discussing.
Well, there's more than one. The thing is that we don't have much data on Eris. We have tons of good data now on Pluto. We know that it was, repurposed on the surface. There's all kinds of ancient arcologies, geometry, things split open. There's an atmosphere. There's heat inside. Where's that coming from? But we almost have nothing on Eris because nothing has been close enough to see it other than its point of light, except for its orbit. There's a lot of objects in the Kuiper Belt that have weird orbits. In fact, there's one, I forget the name offhand, that none of the mainstream guys can figure out under any kind of celestial mechanics how it could have arrived in the orbit that it's in. Because
but it's not the Kuiper Belt. Eris is in our solar system.
Well, anything beyond Pluto
is
Eris the
Kuiper
Belt.
Main
belt. No, Eris is part of the Kuiper Belt. You're thinking of Ceres.
Yeah, Ceres is main belt.
Yeah, main belt.
Okay.
Yeah, Eris is in the Kuiper Belt, and it's almost.
I'm just saying,
Go ahead.
Well, we're. I don't like to leave angles out. We're missing an angle here.
May I correct something?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's a trans-Neptunian object.
Yeah, so it's in the Kuiper Belt. Anything,
no, the Kuiper
anything
Belt's
beyond,
out, isn't it?
No. Anything beyond Pluto is in the Kuiper Belt.
Well, Neptune is inside Pluto.
Well, it or
at
sometimes,
the moment.
Sometimes.
Yes.
Remember, Pluto's in this wildly eccentric orbit for, you know, planets where it comes inside the orbit of Neptune. But anything beyond Neptune is basically the Kuiper Belt until you get to the Oort cloud, which I don't think exists, but that's a whole other conversation.
Okay.
So, Ron, you
what I think
something.
What I think we're missing is that they could have been a space-based civilization that settled down here. I'm not talking about the ones initially that, although it could have involved the ones that were in the war that left those battered wrecks floating around out there. If you have a ship, whether it's a warship or a scout ship or anything else, there'll be another larger vessel, not necessarily as fast, that will be a supply ship. And the only sci-fi franchise that ever embraced that was, in fact, the original, mostly the original Battlestar Galactica. They always had that. You know, they worried just as much about their supply ships as they did about their warships. And
well, again,
we
have to be very careful extrapolating Earth models into a space civilization, because once you introduce the idea of hyperdimensional physics and the torsion field, you don't have to mine anything. You make it out of empty space. You know, you basically construct particles from virtual reality.
Yeah, maybe.
Any size, any form, any shape, because you have infinite energy and you have infinite access to hyperdimensions. So the idea of mining, the 19th century idea of mining something, is kind of archaic and obsolete, and we're at the top of the hour. So I'm going to cut everybody off nicely and say that this rather spirited discussion is going to continue when we come back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we're definitely in the next 3 minutes, are definitely going to return.
OtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Thank you.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night, October 16th, 2022. We're discussing, how did we get here? And did NASA just perform an experiment, either wittingly with cover stories galore, or unwittingly with cover stories kind of post-impact, that really have penetrated two levels of the lie we've been living for the last 50 years, which is that A, we're not alone, B, we've had no extraordinary ancient high-level civilizations in the solar system except us ever, and B, we're not heirs to an extraordinary legacy that most of us not only don't even understand is out there, but we've been deliberately kept away from it by NASA for over half a century. These ideas all came together in the DART experiment, because the DART spacecraft, 1,200 pounds, hitting Dimorphos, the little guy, 600 feet across at over 14,000 miles an hour, created an extraordinary, stunning, overwhelming detonation of extraordinary energies. And NASA has now gone to great lengths in their PR efforts to try to explain away what really happened. And we'll get into that momentarily. The other idea is that what NASA did, again, either deliberately or inadvertently, it destroyed a time capsule set up for a future generation of humanity that would develop spaceflight, be able to go out into the asteroid belt, rendezvous with something like Dimorphos and Didymos, go inside and find out who we really are. Returning to our conversation, gentlemen.
Richard?
Ron, go for it.
Yeah, I wanted to clarify two things, and then I'll wait for something else for me to get outraged about. First off, so that it doesn't show up on Twitter, Deimos is not 30,000 miles from Mars. It's 20,000 kilometers.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Phobos is 5,000 miles and change, and Deimos is 10,000 miles and change. And they are clearly the big prizes, at least as far as I'm concerned. You know, ever since Shlovsky back in the 50s, it was perceived that Phobos had to be hollow, and that starts this whole thing. And you've got the same kind of thing. You've got a pairing. You've got a little one and a big one. And Deimos looks like one of those big ship things that in the asteroid belt, apparently. It's got that same, turns out to have that same top sort of shape. They call it a top. So what are we going to do?
Well, Didymos looks more like a squished hamburger. I mean, that was what struck me, Andrew, is the symmetry.
Yes, yes.
It's kind of like a very bloated flying saucer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it's apparently got a little more depth than that than we thought from the pictures we've seen before. I guess it's
Well, I think I think Shushenko did some geographic reorganization. And allowed for the high angle that we came into the plane of the system, and so gave us a more rectified equatorial view. And he may have used some of the post-impact data from the Lycia cube satellite to generate that kind of three-dimensional geometry. But yeah, I mean, when you see the movie, which is my item number three, this is the official NASA approach and recession movie. As you go whipping around very close, like 30 miles away, you can see it's a squished hamburger, particularly in some of the middle frames. You know, we'll get better data maybe someday. In fact, that's probably a good entry point. Why don't we, you know, let me serve up the next level of impossible things before breakfast, and then we can all have fun arguing about them. Okay?
Okay.
Can I say something before you go there?
Yeah, sure, Robert.
Please.
Yeah, something. My intuition is really pulling me back to Eris. I'd like to say Eris is the ninth most massive object in the solar system. It has a moon named Dysnomia. And everything about this planetoid has been named by NASA with really negative connotations, starting with Eris.
Wow, Dysnomia.
dysnomia. Yeah.
Yeah,
so
she showed up at a wedding and she wasn't supposed to come and cause great discord and all that, I think.
Yeah.
And she stole the silverware.
Yeah, and her mother, Eris, of course, is the goddess of disharmony. So,
discord.
Discord, disharmony.
I'm a Discordian, long-time follower.
Well, look,
if
NASA at some deep metaphysical ritual level is trying to be very Emily Dickinson, you know, tell all the truth but tell it slant, then the names they attach to this, like Didymos and Dimorphos, are very telling at a higher level. We just have to figure out the code and decode what the metaphors are trying to tell us without them coming right out and saying it.
Exactly. Its size is about 1,400 miles.
Yeah, but the same size as Pluto. In fact, it's slightly bigger than Pluto.
Slightly bigger than Pluto. So this is not an insignificant object. So,
guys, speaking of Pluto, one of the moons of Pluto has a Didymos-like shape as well, that sort of squishy flying saucer hamburger look. Again, is this a model?
Look like spaceships. Yeah, when New Horizons flew by, it's easy to tell the real big guys from the spaceships that were parked. Again, so we go inside and find the goodies. The question is, who's finding the goodies, and why don't the rest of us even know it exists?
Richard, is there any way to tell when I'm looking at your number 4 in the DART Lycia Cube post-impact nebula, is there any way to measure what might have been inside of Didymos?
What I wanted our exquisite sketch artist to do, but he's too busy working for the mouse, so he couldn't do it this week. But what I want you to all look at now, let us go to the number. And let me get the proper number up here. This is number 4, okay? This is, again, a guy named Schmaus, which I found interesting. Simon Schmaus, or Simeon Schmaus, citizen scientist, took the NASA data and the Italian data. This is from the Italian, CubeSat, and did an exquisite job showing the extraordinary nebula created after impact, and this was just taken by Lycia Cube probably 20 minutes, 30 minutes after impact and when it was well past the system on the other side from the approach images that they took going in. And what I see is what would happen if Dimorphos was a hollow ship-like object. Think of it as a big container ship, because its actual size is 600 feet. Container ships can go all the way up to 1,200 feet. So it's a kind of a modest container ship, like the one you went out and touched on the in the bay the other day we were talking about. And if you take something and blow it up inside, and then you take a series of still images of the expansion of the interior bulkheads and corridors and rooms and passageways and tunneling, that's what you see. Look at all that three-dimensional rectilinear cubical geometry. It's like it was the interior warren of cubicles and passageways and tunnels blown up on a multi-mile scale and frozen by the picture. Do you see
Richard?
In this picture,
you remember last week I talked about the false color that NASA used that left a patina of material on Didymos. In this one, it's blue. Look at the shell of material that's been left on Didymos. Mm-hmm. And now in colored in blue, it looks like a big, thick coating of blue goo.
Well, we don't know what's causing the colors. The colors are as accurate.
They just inverted the image. The red is probably
the color's not important. It's the material that it represents. And if you look at the central explosive part of the remnants of Dimorphos up in the upper left-hand corner at the 11 o'clock position, you see that same color, color-coded blue. So there have to be several types of material copiously encased in that thing.
Well, just if we are assuming that the color corresponds to resonant fluorescent lines or emission, something at high temperature, which is emitting energy, it's not reflecting sunlight, it's literally been energized by the extraordinary release of energy with the impact on Dimorphos. And Ron, you were going to say something.
Yeah, well, I was and I will. But the blue is the color of Cherenkov radiation. So it's, it may be intentional or not, but I'm not. That one of the easiest ways to tell if a picture has been messed with is to invert it and look at the negative form.
Yeah, I do that in my last item for tonight with one of
it's self-explanatory if somebody ever tries it. Yeah, but I wanted to say one thing, Richard. You said earlier that we can't presume to know about these the motives, et cetera, of these other civilizations that may have interacted, and yet you carry the premise that all civilizations or technical societies develop at the same pace and through the same steps. It's quite possible that a lot of the stuff left behind would be useless to us, not because we don't understand the physics, but because it was in a different direction. It happens. You know, it's like the Romans
cement. What do you mean by direction? Give me an example.
I'm about to. Romans had a cement which was different from but equivalent to the cement that was used in ancient Egypt, and they're much stronger, and they grow stronger with age instead of weaker, like the modern cement does. And we didn't know until just a few years ago why that happened. Nobody could figure it out. And this was the Romans, who we were arguably, technically, much more advanced than the Romans, even 100 years ago.
Yeah, but do we know that the Romans invented it themselves, or did they get it from an ancient source? Like Sam Osmanagic, remember, has found this extraordinary cement in his pyramids in Bosnia, and it's much stronger than contemporary cements. And again, I think we're looking at
heritage
technology, yes.
No, this is just chemistry, and anyone could stumble into it at any stage.
Right.
Because their knowledge of chemistry was advanced enough. What gave them the idea? I don't know. If it's a mechanism or some chain of events that you can say they got it from somewhere else. But
it could be a sacred scroll, handed down information in the priesthood. Keep secret and only keep it in your guild and never tell anybody how you do it?
Yeah, guild secret is fair. But it's, you know what it is? Salt water. That was normally thought to be a contaminant that would cause problems. But by mixing in a certain amount of salt water, you start this secondary chemical reaction after the cement dries, and it makes it harder and stickier than it was before. But it took us.
Yeah,
Sam
has been on the show talking about how he's given samples of this concrete in Bosnia to, geopolymer people and concrete people and all that. And they've attested, yes, it's better than anything we're currently producing. And they back engineered it, and they now know how to produce it.
With salt water.
I don't remember the details. Okay, I just remember.
Well, I don't either, but it has to be the same thing. That's where they got it.
One more thing.
It got passed.
Okay, we're going to run out of time here, and I want to prove my point that these things are artificial. So if you'll let me go to the numbers. Item number 4 shows the extraordinary energy released, which NASA did not expect. And Andrew, this extraordinary geometry just minutes after the explosion, which looks to me like an expansion, kind of like the inflation model of the universe that some cosmologists talked about many years ago, where you take a curtain geometry and then you expand it at a furious speed, but it maintains its internal shape, its internal morphology. It looks to me like we're expanding the interior hollowed out compartmentalized geometry, the ship-like geometry of Dimorphos, i.e. like an aircraft carrier or merchant ship here on Earth. Okay, you with me?
Yeah.
Okay. Item number 5, this is the geometry of how they did it. They smashed the DART spacecraft, which is the big guy at the bottom of the graphic, into Dimorphos, which is coming around in the opposite direction, head-on collision. And the collision is supposed to have imparted something between 4,000 and 6,000 pounds of TNT equivalent kinetic energy, okay? Which sounds like a lot, and on Earth it can destroy a city block, but on the order of asteroids, you know, huge mountains orbiting each other, the angular momentum and the masses and all that are such that they really estimated that they would maybe change the velocity of Dimorphos to where it would assume a slightly smaller and therefore faster orbit by 71 seconds. The outer range that I saw published was like 10 minutes. What they got was 33 minutes. Now, where do I get 33? They are saying 32, but that covers a plus or minus 2 minutes in their error bars, so it's really in the mid-range 33. Why is that important? Because they hit this sucker exactly when the Didymo system was at minus 33 degrees and change on the Earth celestial coordinate system of so-called declination and right ascension. It was at minus 33 in the southern hemisphere, tracking north in the constellation of Lepus, which, as Georgia told us last weekend, was in fact a hare which was used in a lot of sacrificial ceremonies. So, Robert, we're building on these kind of metaphorical inner layers that they don't tell us about. Oh, and in Washington, the impact occurred when the Didymo system was 7 tetrahedral degrees above the southern horizon. The numbers are very intriguing and do not look accidental. For one thing, how could you decide to smash into something at minus 33 and then have the actual period change by 33 minutes? That would imply you knew exactly the masses, the energies, the densities, and you'd done all your calculations, and you knew what you were going to do was going to trigger the release of enough energy to change Dimorphos orbit by that precise ritual amount. And number 6, again, is a different processing of the dual image that Andrew and I have been talking about. Number 7 is where the kind of heart of how we now know that Dimorphos was a spaceship comes from. Click on that. This is a comparison of the old period of Dimorphos orbiting Didymos on the left, 11 hours, 55 minutes, and then the new period, 11 hours, 23 minutes, okay? Now, there's a very simple, here's where the math comes in, a very simple equation for what happens when you hit one object with another object. It's called kinetic energy. And there are two equations. One is F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration, or you can invert that equation and you can get the mass from the acceleration and the force you apply. And the other is the kinetic energy, 1/2 mb². The important part there is the square, because the amount of energy you deliver in a big pinball machine like the solar system when you smash objects together depends to a first order on their mass, but much more important because it's the square of their velocity. And this thing was moving at 4.1 miles per second, which is over 25,000 feet per second. And explosions, TNT and whatever, they have blast waves that are on the order of 9,000 feet per second. So this thing delivered an extraordinary amount of energy into a system in a head-on collision. Even then, what they got, the effects they got, so exceeded by a factor of 3 their previously published estimate of the 10-minute change in orbit. I mean, they're claiming now that they had actually estimated 30 minutes. I have not seen that published anywhere. That they pulled out of their you-know-what at that press conference, because nowhere was it ever written down they could get a 30-minute change, which was 3 times their best estimate before. So what does that do in terms of those equations? Well, since none of the factors that we know have changed, in other words, you know the mass of the spacecraft, you know the velocity, you know the energy that you're imparting when you hit something, the fact that they got a 3 times bigger result in the equation, it means that the mass of Dimorphos had to be 1/3 as much as they were estimating. This is crucial. They were off by a factor of 3, if we believe the numbers, from what they were estimating. Now, where did their estimate come from? You'll see in these published papers pre-impact that they estimated that Dimorphos and Didymos were basically chips off the same block. They were made of the same stuff. They were either rocky asteroids, I mean they were solid and they had a certain density, or they were rubble piles and they had the same density but made of big boulders and big blocks all kind of smushed together, held together under gravity, not tension, chemical tension between the molecules of the rock. And so when you smash those objects, they both basically were supposed to have the same density, which was 2.7 grams per cubic centimeter. Water has a density of 1. So they were almost 3 times more dense in these pre-impact NASA estimates based on lots of asteroid data, lots of observations, other missions, whatever. They assumed that they were, that both objects, big one and small one, had that density of 2.7 grams per cubic centimeter. However, so because we only have from their orbit around each other a total mass for the system, which was billions and billions and billions of tons, we do not have a separate mass for Didymos or Dimorphos separately. That would come from the impact. So again, following really simple, simple high school physics, they got 3 times the effect that they expected. Well, that would say that the density, given that we now have the size, the density of Dimorphos had to be 1/3 of 2.7 grams per cubic centimeter. And that puts us down at about 0.75. Here's the punchline. And that's in the range of hollow buildings with rooms or ships with compartments or aircraft carriers with hangars, whatever. In other words, the very extraordinary change of energy imparted to Dimorphos proves, because of the density, that this object was not an asteroid, not a rubble pile of asteroid-type stuff, but basically a constructed, artificially compartmentalized ship with a density of 0.75 grams per cubic centimeter, i.e., it was an artificial ship. And the numbers, NASA's own numbers, prove it.
Richard, this is an interesting thing you've brought up in comparing the density of Dimorphos to water, because my impression, though I didn't express it when I described what I saw, was that something had been liquefied and that goo on that's the residue that's on Didymos, and then the streams of matter, something got liquidated. And there must have been a tremendous amount of heat in that impact. So I think there's a case to be made that this object was full of some liquid of some sort.
Well, it could have been water. Remember, if you're dealing with a spaceship, one of the things you have to carry with you is consumables, right? Water.
Yes.
Yeah.
And air. Water, it would be a source of fuel if you separate the water into the oxygen and the hydrogen.
No. Stop thinking about it. We're talking hyperdimensional physics. We're talking torsion fields. We're talking anti-gravity. We're not talking rockets. No. But human beings, for millions of years, have not been redesigned. We still need to breathe. We still need to drink. We still need to eat. So we're talking about internal sources of water for the crew or the personnel and foodstuffs, forests, whatever ecosystem was inside these ships, because they're basically little mini worlds, more likely Didymos than Dimorphos. Dimorphos looks to me like a big tramp steamer, 600 feet with whatever volume is, But because of the impact and the energies and the change of period, this is crucial. This is the numbers. Dr. Eddington, these are the numbers that we have to go on to change it by a factor of three. The density had to be down by a factor of three, and that makes it an artificial construct, not a natural asteroid.
Well, that's valid if we assume that the entity that created it is humanoid and organic. If it's robotic or AI.
Remember, our model is that this is all about the family, the human family, which is much, much, much more ancient than anybody has even dared imagine. And in terms of the war, I think the war was a civil war. Where do I get that idea? One is the biggest fights are in families. Keith knows that for, you know, full well. And in the terms of the human race, what are we doing to each other right now? What's the whole East versus West, Putin versus Biden, et cetera? It's within the human family. So the worst fights are family. So I've been looking at this as a civil war. And then you go all the way back to Genesis. And that appears to have been a civil war between God and his angels and the devil and his cohorts, but the same fandamily.
Same thing in the Nordic myths. Yeah, you can you could find that in all of them. This is kind of a setup question for you, because I know you've read as many of those technical papers as I have. One of the things they should have mentioned, it's number one on the list of objectives in every single coverage of, you know, projection as to what they were going to do when they got there, was determine the mass of Dimorphos.
Well, that's...
I haven't seen a published number.
They assume, because at the press conference, the only thing they talked about, besides giggling and chortling and acting, Andrew, almost obscenely happy at what they'd done, and I'm cringing because I know what they've really done, and like you, it's like the greatest sin and travesty and heresy you can imagine to destroy your heritage and be giggling about it. And the only thing I can attribute is that those people that we see have no idea what they've really done. They bought the standard model. They're good little robots, good little soldiers. They think they're doing something good, and they're actually doing something very evil, which is destroying the link to who we really are and what we're doing in this place. Be that as it may, the only number they would again and again reiterate was the change of period. They said all the other things that they should be able to figure out was still a work in progress. And for that, I think they were telling the absolute truth, because in their model, what I've just described is absolutely effing impossible. Impossible. And they'll never get there.
45 seconds.
They will never get there. Anyway,
to start a Deadpool.
We are at
the
hang on. We have to do this after the bottom of the hour. My guests this morning, Ron Gerbron, Robert Morningstar, Andrew Curry, Keith Morgan. Keith Laney must be thinking about us or listening. Keith Morgan is there behind the scenes running dials and chipping in with very intriguing insights. That thing on Didymos. Very provocative. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
The other side of midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night, October 16th, 2022. My guests this morning and I are discussing a radical, extraordinary, mind-blowing, and still totally covered up by NASA hypothesis, which I hope I have now demonstrated. We basically have confirmed NASA's own numbers, taking their pre-impact published densities for Dimorphos and Didymos, and the energy imparted by the approaching and then impacting 1,200-pound DART spacecraft, and the incredible change of orbital period from 11 hours, 55 minutes, a whisker under 12 hours. By the way, we'll get in the next few minutes into why the orbit is not 12 hours. I mean, wouldn't you think the ancients would be sophisticated enough and precise enough that if they meant 12, they would left us 12? Well, there's a clue in the fact that it was not 12 anymore. It was 11:55. And Ron, you're going to remind me to get into that when we come back. The other thing is, if you take all those parts of the equation and know that the only variable in order to get that incredible orbit change from 11:55 down to 11:23 or 24, if it is what I think, 33-minute difference, that implies implacably, there's no wiggle room here, that the density of Dimorphos was not the same as Didymos. In fact, it reduces the density by a factor of 3 to keep the mass the same in that equation. And that gives us the densities of artificial buildings or giant ships like Nimitz-class aircraft carriers that we build with big empty volumes, spaces like hangar decks here on Earth. In other words, by NASA's own numbers, they smashed into an ancient spaceship. Why would they do that? Unless they didn't know. Okay, we're all back. Who wants to go first and tear me apart?
I would.
Go for it.
Richard, do we have any chemical analysis of these streamers that are vomiting out into space? Or that
incredibly prescient question. I have tasked Chandra Wickrama Singh behind the scenes to try to reach some of his compatriots with Webb that was doing stunning real-time monitoring and spectroscopic analysis of all the stuff we see coming out in that astonishing picture. And I'm trying to get him on for next weekend, but I need to be able to, he had to go on vacation. His wife insisted, you know how that is, right, Andrew? And so he was unable to complete his mission. Now that he's back, he'll have a week to try to get hold of somebody. That seems to be the easiest thing for NASA to tell us what was all the stuff that came out, right? They had the perfect spacecraft for the perfect instrumentation, the perfect view. They haven't said a word. Nothing. Zip. Nada. Because if this really was a spaceship, then we should see all kinds of organic materials, including, Robert, a lot of water coming out of something which basically held hundreds of people at one time, if not more.
Richard, is there any way that we could conduct our own experiment, like put some sort of water and life in a container and blow it up in a vacuum and see what it would look like? Is there any way to do something?
Yeah, but nobody would believe it. You know, all we have to do is get the data declassified, because I imagine there are amateurs all over the world, amateur astronomers, who have done something like this by themselves because it was so available to their technology.
Right.
And I'm just, through my network of amateur astronomers, citizen scientists, I am pursuing quietly behind the scenes, tracking down those people. But obviously, I don't want to identify them on the air, because then you know who's going to swoop in and basically, you know, hold up a badge and say national security, you can't say a word. So we need to keep them kind of off the books until I get to the right people. But we're working on that behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I just want to...
Andrew, don't blow up things in your backyard.
No, I would not do that. I don't think Andrew was going to do that. You know, he has a young son. He does not want to teach the wrong lesson to your young son. So,
to only see his family on visiting days. That's the jail.
Yeah. Well, Halloween is coming up at the fire.
So anyway, someone please take a long sword and poke a hole in my model, because to me, the numbers are conclusive, because you can't make mass vanish.
No, I just wanted to say, before the break, I want to set up a Deadpool. It's hypothetical.
Tell us what a Deadpool is, please.
Oh, I thought everybody had seen that annoying movie with Ryan
Reynolds.
No,
I've deliberately not seen the annoying movie.
Well, they're usually a time frame thing. It's just, it's a lottery. It's like people picking who's going to win the Super Bowl or something like that.
Okay.
This regards how much of Dimorphos is left. In my mind, there's a little less than 25% of the hull still there.
Okay.
That would be my guess. And if somebody wants to say, no, it's all there or it's all gone or something like that, you know, they can weigh in and get bragging rights when we finally find out. But because I had no doubts from before they arrived that it was a ship. And I didn't think it would explode, but I did think it would bust up. And the hull would be the sturdiest part. So I know NASA's model, I believe, was for the structural. They have structural and rubble pile models. And for the structural asteroid model, I guess the front runner would be Hyperion. That's the one that looks like a loofah sponge.
Right.
You know, with all those cavities in it, you know, that would give reinforcement and all that other stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Hyperion seems to be an ancient, very barge ship.
Yeah.
As does Iapetus. Remember the bulge around Iapetus? If you whittle away a lot of Iapetus, what did it used to look like? Maybe Bennu or Ryugu or Dimorphos or Didymos? And how much is real? How much is natural? And how much is built up stuff like Trantor on top of an ordinary, you know, planetary moon-sized body? Iapetus is 900 miles across.
By the way, mass does disappear if it turns into energy. And just a minor note on Latin. The I in Latin is pronounced like a J. So it's Iapetus or Japetus.
I like Iapetus.
Okay.
Anyway, Steelers choice. Anyway.
Regional pronunciation. Yes.
Anyway, do we want to get to the next part? Because the next part gets really interesting. And that's
let's
where...
Go
ahead.
No, I said let's go.
Okay.
Get to the next...
yeah. Item number 8. This is a photograph that was taken by an amateur, and all the data is on the thing. You just click on it and you click on it, it only goes once, but all the data is there. Four guys from Chile, because remember, this was overhead in Chile because it was in the southern hemisphere of the Earth, only plus seven from Washington. Altitude 42.5 degrees, phase angle 55 degrees, et cetera, et cetera. All the data is on those little data blocks. What you want to focus on is the center object. This is a time-lapse image taken of Didymos, the system, 2 days after impact. And you can see in the lower right-hand corner, what they did is they did a little inset of the core brightness. They were very clever. They basically turned their photograph, which is on the left, into a positive. And then they did what's called solarization, where they assign colors to brightness. So the colors are not real. The colors are just arbitrary. But what you want to do is look at the geometry. And actually, it's better if you look at number 9, because what I instantly realized was, oh, my God, look at that. On the left, remember the Tonga explosion, the weird underwater volcanic explosion, which released more energy than any underwater volcano in the history of the Earth and sent plumes up into the almost near space and shockwaves around the world for days and all that. It basically was a cube. I'm intrigued with cubes because cubes, as you can see in the center panel, are double tetrahedrons, which are signatures of the physics. Going from a higher dimension into three-dimensional reality, you get a cube initially because you have two conjoined tetrahedrons making up the form. The object on the right is an enlargement of the post-impact Didymos system 2 days after impact by the amateur astronomers in Chile, and the cloud of dust that had now moved out several hundred miles from the center of the teeny tiny Didymos system, which is smaller on this scale than one of those pixels. It was a cubical shape. Which takes us to number 10. Why is number 10 interesting? Because all over the solar system, on the moon, on Phobos, on Mars, on the outer moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and anywhere where we see impact craters, there's been this incredible mystery for decades, if not a century or more. There's a huge number of impact craters that are not circular, like you'll see the little circular craters in on this scale, but they're actually geometric. They are six-sided. And I believe it's because their creation involved the use of hyperdimensional torsion field energy, i.e., they may not be ordinary impacts. They may be the signature ancient use of a hyperdimensional weapon, which literally pulls energy from hyperspace into 3D and blows things to kingdom come. And I believe if we now go to item number 11, this is now taken by another amateur group also in Chile. All the good views were in Chile. This was taken 3 days after impact. And you can begin to see in this black and white image, the little streaky things are time lapse stars, because remember the asteroid is moving relative to the star field, because the star field is the background and the comet is because of that damn tail, the asteroid, which we turn into with this impact into a comet, is moving against the star field. So you have to pick one or the other to have as a point. So the obvious decision here was to pick Didymos to track, and the stars were thereby streaked. So that takes us to the next image, which is the SOAR telescope, which is in the southern hemisphere at a major observatory called Cerro Tololo, which is in Chile, South America. 4 meter diameter mirror, 12 feet, time-lapse exposure. Here the star streaks are multicolored because they took red, green, and blue, as opposed to a simultaneous color image. And on this scale now, this is 48 hours, about the same as the object that you see, item numbers 8 and 9. But here, the scale is so much smaller because they're doing a wide angle view. And in the center, you see this weird geometry. And if you look at 13, the geometry on left and right. On left is kind of the raw data, and right is the geometry that I had John Womack putting on the graphic. And you can see there's an inner and outer tracing of a inner and outer giant tetrahedral geometry, like the cube, as the energy dissipates, collapses to one form or the other, one tetrahedron or the other of the dual tetrahedrons. And the reason we're seeing it at all is because of all the dust that was produced, which scatters sunlight and which creates that extraordinary narrow beam. Now, the mainstream explanation for the beam is that it's dust particles in the plane of the orbit, which is being streaked out by radiation pressure from the sun. However, if we go back to item number 9, and you look at the geometry of the cube, and then you look at the geometry of the double tetrahedron next to it, and then you look at that little fledgling tail, you know, a few hours, this is like a day or so after the, 48 hours after the beginning, after the impact, you'll see that that streak, the beginning of the longer tail, appears to have a certain geometry with the three-dimensional tetrahedral form. And I'm beginning to suspect that that geometry, when we do it all, you know, kind of in a nice little ball, it will come out at 19.5 degrees from the way the tetrahedron is oriented in space. In other words, it's an energy input, hyperdimensionally powered, exactly like the hyperdimensional signatures we see in the sun, in the Earth, in Jupiter, the big volcanoes on Mars, the great dark spot on Neptune, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, either deliberately or inadvertently, NASA created the biggest hyperdimensional energy release in the solar system, maybe in millions of years. And then, of course, the question is, why? A, did the folks carrying this out know what they were doing, or were they conned into it by folks higher up that knew what they were doing and got them to do it as part of a planetary defense cover story? Or are there people inside that understood that if they did this, and they did it by the numbers, when the Didymo system was at the right latitude and longitude and right ascension and declination and elevation to Earth, that hyperdimensional pulse would have an effect on human consciousness here on Earth, equivalent to what normal hyperdimensional astrology does every single day, which is why I've got Rick Levine working on the numbers and the alignments and the oppositions and trines and squares and all that. And I'm hoping to have him on the show next Saturday night to tell us what he has found. But my bet is that none of this is accidental. The numbers are too coincidental to be coincidence. I think somebody wanted to do something like create a huge tremor in the force. And Andrew, that's why you've been feeling weird.
Yep. I'm telling you, Richard, especially this last week, but definitely recently. That's the only kind of bracketing I can say. And the only way I can describe this, and again, this comes from me, so it's my filtration. It's my filters, right? And I'm getting older, and I'm changing, and da-da-da-da-da-da. There's all that. But this feeling I've had, it's like we've entered a completely alien environment, like a whole different landscape. When I look out at the world, it's the same world, but the feeling that I have in it is completely alien. And when I say that, I'm not putting a value statement. I didn't say that was negative or positive. It's just extraordinarily different for me. And my wife has said the same thing. Like Anna has said the same thing. You know, it's just a very strange feeling. And the thing about it, sometimes, you know, you get an odd feeling about a day, and I know Robert and I talk about this a lot. We all do, right? But this just continues to wash over and over. It just continues to soak in. It's not like switching gears, you know, like a few days later. It just settles in more and more. That's the only way I can describe it. It may sound weird, Richard, but it's unsettling, but it's not.
Well, not compared to what we're looking at, because I think this was the trigger, and I think somebody designed this under a cover story to be the trigger for this hyperdimensional pulse. Because remember, in the model, the physics itself is neutral. What happens is who is washed over by this wave of higher dimensional energy information. Remember, I've been saying for many, many years, this causes the good to get better and the bad to get worse. So it's like turning up the gain on an amplifier. And Robert, you're another sensitive. You perceive something so strange and so weird, but in consistency with this model, not unexpected.
I know. I think there's something that Andrew and I both have that psychic sense, and so I'm not surprised that there is a disturbance in the force.
Well,
I think
I've been feeling weird, you know, and I don't normally, you know, I try to, when you're trying to do science and numbers, you try not to go by what you feel, but what the numbers are telling you. Right. Believe me, everything is going weird. I know people in my life that are being absolutely bonkers, that are acting so out of character, so 180 degrees from the way they normally have acted, that I'm wondering if this is kind of like a CAT scan and revealing that their previous behavior was all an act, and this is revealing who they really are without mentioning names.
Well, remember the analogy I made last week about balancing a tire or balancing
a tire?
They've just slid. They just slid the lead slug that keeps the wheel in balance. So there is a disturbance in the force.
See, I need to find out from Rick where this occurred in terms of all the geometry, the spider web of hyperdimensional connections that all these rotating processing objects did. Because you know what we did when NASA hit this thing? It changed its precession. And precession, force precession, is how you get unlimited energy out of hyperdimensions. That's the secret of the magnetic machines. Steve, what's his name? Who's the guy in North Carolina? Stephen Greer. He's come out suddenly with four new technologies for accessing hyperdimensional physics. They're all force precession in one way or another. We have never had an experiment where NASA literally changed an orbit of one body orbiting another body. And the reason they didn't do it to a single object is if you do it to a single object, the effect is much less than if you do it to two orbiting objects. And they did one hell of an experiment and got a stunning result that they're frankly, their PR release on what they did, it's nonsense. It's crazy. They're basically saying that this the overwhelming energy coming out was because they got a more efficient ejection of rocks from the crater.
Why?
You can't get thing from nothing in any conventional 3D Newtonian model. The total energy gives you the total effect. The only way this energy would have disappeared would be if it went into heat. The problem is the efficiency of heat transmission in rock is so minimal. That's why solar collectors work so efficiently, you know, at night as opposed to day, because it takes like hours and hours for the heat to leak through the rock, that the energy conversion into heat inside Dimorphos, assuming it was a rock, would have been trivial compared to the kinetic energy of the pinball hitting one ball with another. So the idea that some PR idiot wrote the press release without consulting any physicists or any celestial mechanics experts and basically said, oh, well, the reason the period changed so radically is because it was much more efficient at ejecting rocks. If you know anything about the rocket equation, the reason you want the smallest mass of reactants in a rocket, like hydrogen and oxygen, is because you want the lowest molecular weight to accelerate it to a highest velocity. Remember, E equals mb squared, velocity squared. So tossing out big rocks would be incredibly inefficient and would not account for the change of Dimorphos orbit at all, whereas more energy than they expected and a lower density would.
Hey, Richard, I just found out something very interesting. Lipus, the constellation in which this thing occurred is directly south of Orion.
Yes, of course, right next to Canis Major.
Well, it looks like they wanted to shoot him in the foot.
Well, again, you can, you know, spin the metaphor wherever way, but it's in that part of the of the celestial sphere that has incredible meaning mythologically for humans and who's been tinkering with us and where family went after the war.
Well, I think that Orion has an astronomical influence on Earth and all events on Earth as well.
Well, yeah, of course, of course.
That's just astrology.
Was anyone else bothered by the trajectory of what we see right after the blast? I mean, to me, that's unlike any portrayal or anything else of a zero-G, zero-atmosphere explosion that I've ever seen. I mean, the stuff's... it's like there was some sort of material or matrix that it was traveling through, you know. So that's why I
that's
told
what
Richard
I meant. The hollowed rooms and corridors and tunnels, and you simply blow up everything like inflation instantaneously, but you preserve the geometry because there's no air resistance.
Yeah, but they shouldn't those be straight trajectories instead of those
exactly
snaky tendrils?
That is says you had Reynolds numbers, which were exceeded in terms of vorticity. How do you get vorticity in a vacuum? You only get vorticity in a gun barrel. Think of Gerald Bull and his big, big, you know, super gun or that kind of thing. In other words, if you have a artificial object, a ship, with corridors that run from one end of the ship to the other, and they're basically, if you blow something up inside, they're huge gun barrels. For a few microseconds, they will constrain the explosion within the walls, creating enormous vorticity that when the walls go away, the vorticity remains and is frozen and expanding. In other words, I think, and that's why I wanted you to do a sketch, Andrew, I think we're seeing the internal 3D geometry of Dimorphos, the ship, exploded on a huge scale because of the explosion inside.
So you're almost describing it like those, in the movie Alien and Aliens, when they brought out the ground plans for the complex they were in to try to get away from the pursuing aliens.
Yes.
This is the map of the ship.
Yes.
This is the map.
Yes, you're seeing it in three dimensions. And if we can take the light, Leica cube images and look at various angles, because they went through the system and we got 3D and mapped them in some kind of computer program, we'll be able to reconstruct the interior geometry in those first few minutes before the hyperdimensional effects of the changing momentum of the entire system overtook everything, I think. And you probably hear music in the background. We're at the top of the hour. My guests this morning are Ron Gerbron, Andrew Curry, and Robert Morningstar, and Keith Morgan is with us in the control room. You're on the other side of midnight. We now have a whole hour to talk about and fight amongst ourselves as to what all this ultimately means, and then we're going to bring up a surprise subject, the Antarctic, because it is related, as you will see. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment for your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight on this now Sunday night, Monday morning. It is officially the 17th of October, 2021, here in the Land of Enchantment. So, Sunday night, Monday morning, our guests are still with us, our panelists, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask if you want to join the conversation, if you want to ask us any questions, or if you have some really interesting ideas of your own for what we're seeing, give us a call. What you want to do is call 917-889-8802. 917-889-8802. That way you can join the conversation. I also want to invite any computer graphics folks out there to take this data and do some amazing things with it so we can help out our overworked and overloaded enterprise mission imaging team members who are doing yeoman service, but they have day jobs, and so they have to do other things too. And the more on this, the merrier, because you may see things that we miss and vice versa. That phone should not be ringing. That is not our, that's probably someone from the other side of the planet who wants to join the conversation, but you have to join 917-889-8802. I have a suspicion who that might be, but I can't pick up the phone right now, so we're going to hang it up. One final thing. To do all this stuff, to keep this show on the air, particularly as we're getting down to crunch time, really requires resources. I know we just went through a little promo there, but I want to reemphasize that there are two ways that you can support the show. One is you can join Club 19.5. You can recommend it to your friends, your fellows, anywhere in the world. It's accessible all over the planet. We're in 190 some countries, so they can reach the show anywhere they are on Earth, even in the middle of the South Pacific. We have that little spinning globe, and you can see where people have logged in from all over the world. That's one way you can do it, and you can even give out kind of gifts. We're getting close to the end of the year season, and it would be useful if you were to think ahead and maybe give a subscription to The Other Side of Midnight to someone on your Christmas list. That would behoove them, because as we get through the end of this year and into next year, all you know what is going to hit the rotating kitchen appliance. And I am not fooling. There are three spacecraft that are going to reach the moon. Two of them are en route. One of them will be launching in less than a month, and it may be launching during the show on Sunday night, the 13th/14th, in which case we will be going live. That's going to be a show that night. We're going to devote to all the stuff on the moon that nobody wants to talk about, which either the Artemis cameras can image for us, or the Capstone camera, or the Danuri cameras. There are several, including a polarimeter, and polarimeters are gadgets that really look at reflections. And you can't have a lot of glass on the moon without there being stunning, documentable, numerical reflections that will show up in the data. And all we have to do is make sure the data is published. So that's the one way you can support the show. The other way is to go to The Other Side of Midnight, and in the middle of the top of the main page, the homepage, or on the upper left-hand corner, there is basically a donate button. We could use a little cash infusion right now because there are expenses associated with the show. there are certainly expenses in trying to lobby in Washington to get some of this stuff out there in time for it to have an impact on NASA policy or Elon Musk. We're looking at creating a calendar. Some of us have been discussing a seasonal calendar that would put some of these goodies together in a format that would be useful as a Christmas gift that you could give to all the people on your list who think that your interest in this stuff is totally crazy. When they see the images and they see the descriptions and they see the NASA data, their opinion, certainly given what's been going on in the headlines, on the news, all over social media, a lot of it could change. So you could give them a calendar and then stand back and watch the fun. So we need kind of spending money to make some of these longer range projects happen. And I'm telling you, $5 is amazing. $50 is fantastic. I had people the other day send us $100. You know, I want to thank everyone who has donated to The Other Side of Midnight because it keeps us on the air and things are getting very, very dicey in terms of cash flow and funds because we've lost a few subscribers due to the inflation. That means that you folks that are in better positions economically can take up a little of the slack to keep us in the game for when you know what is going to hit the rotating kitchen appliance. And I must say, given that I'm looking forward now to the Halloween disclosures that are coming that weekend per the Congress and the law that mandates the first, you know, all domain anomaly Pentagon office annual report on UAPs, UFOs, and other things that go bump in the night, that's supposed to hit that weekend. And the 31st, Halloween, is Monday. And Monday, of course, is the anniversary, that Monday, of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds. And given these people's kind of strange dibs on reality, I would not put them past us, past it, for them to release this first annual report literally on Halloween. Again, if we're going to stay in the game, we need a little help. Actually, we need significant help right now because things are becoming very critical. And so I would leave you with a heartfelt plea. If you can help, please do help, because otherwise we will literally not be there when the end game finally arrives. So, gentlemen, back to our conversation. I won't find out until later and maybe never who that guy was who was calling or person who was calling. But we have laid out some very interesting ideas tonight. Where would you like to take the conversation next?
I'd just like to say something about the dispersion pattern of the material there.
Okay.
I would have expected the pattern to be different from a kinetic impact on an object that was not symmetrical, and in the strictest sense of the word. I would have expected it to have a greater density in one area and dissipate, but it looks to me like a spherical explosion, a spherical dispersion pattern. Now, a couple of years ago, and we're going to, it's with the subject we're going to discuss later regarding Antarctica, I made the statement that I had seen in my youth on the way to high school in the 1960s, a photograph of a nuclear explosion over Antarctica. And you contested that. But I can tell you now that on July 6th of 1962, with President Kennedy's authorization, the United States began detonating the first of five hydrogen bombs over Antarctica. And I've seen the films of those detonations. And when those detonations occur in outer space, there's no mushroom. It turns into a star first, and then it dissipates. And this dispersion pattern of Didymus reminds me of that, and it's non-Newtonian dispersion as I see it. So I'd just like to say that. And the operation was actually the nuclear explosions over Antarctica. They were broadcast live to Australia, and it was called Operation Starfish. And I think it had everything to do with UFOs.
Well, hang on a second, because the data I have, Operation Starfish is real. They were delivered into low Earth orbit by rockets coming up from Johnston Island, which is in the middle of the Pacific. And they were so cataclysmic that they literally tripped circuit breakers because of in Hawaii. This is all a matter of public record. But they were not over the Antarctic. They were over because getting to the Antarctic with the Johnson rockets, they did not go into orbit. They were basically ballistic, and they wanted to keep them over the South Pacific where they had cameras at Kwajalein and all that, and they could monitor, you know, what was actually happening. Because if you don't monitor a test, you know, it's like there's a tree fall in the forest and your seeing isn't there to catch it, does it really fall? You know, a test without monitoring is pointless. So they had to do it where they were able to monitor the actual results. So I don't think it may have been seen as flashes on the horizon from the Antarctic, but it was not over the Antarctic. It was over the South Pacific from Johnston Island. And that's the first time they realized the incredible power of EMP, because they tripped circuit breakers on Honolulu power supplies as far away as Hawaii completely inadvertently. So they had to be above the horizon of Hawaii to be visible to do that, because radio waves do not bend, you know, in from straight lines. So it was somewhere over the South Pacific in line of sight from several hundred miles up to the Hawaiian island chain.
We'll have to try to get the real coordinates, but it's my suspicion that those five detonations actually are what caused the ozone hole. But that's another story.
Okay. I mean, that's a valid hypothesis. Again, it's testable by means of numbers. Ron, I think you had something you wanted to say. Did we lose Ron?
No. Oh, yeah. I was on mute. Sorry.
Oh, well, that's always.
Sorry. No, I'm here. Well, you're talking about Antarctica relative to what? What Robert just said affirms my suspicions about the shape of what we see in those after impact pictures. I'm still very puzzled about that. You know, what you say about the internal chambers deflecting things and causing a bunch of new vectors makes perfect sense. But to me, it's something you would think would be mentioned, you know, I mean, by NASA. They go, oh, this is interesting. We're not sure what caused that happened.
They don't want to mention this. That's why it's up to us to bring it to public attention. These are things that are, you know, unmentionable.
Yeah. But I'm still awaiting the proper connection with Antarctica. I mean, I think it's full of ruins down there, but there's a lot of questions, and I don't know what they have to do with, aside from the fact that you could see this little DART operation from down there had you a telescope. I don't know what the connection is yet.
The connection is how things disperse in outer space rather than when they're under gravity. And but Richard wants to talk about his Antarctica later on, so we'll return to that. And I'll give you some information later about the Russian expedition to Antarctica in 1932, which we never hear about. Okay.
No, we never hear about that. That's definitely something we're going to get into.
The Ananurbi expedition? Wow.
Yep.
No, not Ananurbi. Russian. Soviet expedition.
Oh, Russian. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm good.
Stalin sent some people down there in 1932, and they reported back some fascinating things that got them all sent to a gulag.
Well, that's not very good.
No, that's unfortunate. Yeah.
It's very typical of Stalin, when he didn't like the news that he got, to do such things to silence it and not have it heard about ever again. But I'll tell you more about that at the end.
Okay. We'll all be waiting. And for all those people out there, the most famous spot in Antarctica other than McMurdo is probably Lake Vostok, and that was named after a Russian whaling ship that got trapped in the ice there a long time ago. And we're probably the first modern folks to set foot on it.
Hmm. Interesting.
A little piece of trivia that
as long as you brought up Lake Vostok, the Russians bored down 2.5 miles into it. And since they did, they have found over 3,500 new species in the waters that they dredged up.
The waters which have been sealed, we think, for millions of years from the upper level ocean and biology. By the way, there was another story that came out based on underwater sediments analyzed by, I believe, the Australians. They found something like a set of million-year-old DNA in some of the sediments off the coast of Antarctica. And I just briefly, I was sent that link by one of our colleagues, and I didn't have time to read the details, but that would be the oldest DNA successfully recovered of anything on Earth, as far as I know.
There's another strange story that came out of the Russian expeditions into Antarctica during the last 10 years, and it has to do with a group of Russian scientists who went deep, deep into one of those Antarctica caves, ice caves, and encountered a creature in the water that approached them, and they were mesmerized by this creature. And then a tentacle came out and snatched one of the scientists and killed him. And they all had to flee in terror. And it gives me a hint that H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos may have some foundation. In fact, these strange things, which again, we'll talk about it when we get to the Antarctica. And maybe the folks, there's a new link added to Andrew's items there. And it says that there's some strange things are emerging from the melting ice sheet in Antarctica. So you might run that silently and just take a look at the images that we're going to discuss later on in the program.
Yeah. And Keith, if you're monitoring Skype, I just sent you an image for our Antarctic segment in Skype. Just take that and make that my post number 15, please, if you can. So, Andrew, you're being very, very quiet.
Yeah, because you got me looking at these streamers. And
am I crazy, or is there a three-dimensional modeled
geometry
there?
This is a floor plan. Floor plan is the word I was thinking of when I talked about the...
Floor plan is like side view and plane view. This is like a perspective, 3D. Three-dimensional, expanded, frozen. It's got all kinds of detail, including width of walls that I would not expect in random, turbulent, whatever.
Richard, excuse me, Andrew, let me just interrupt with this brief news break. Richard, I visited that area in Google Earth recently.
Which area?
This is called Mount Murray, the one you put down there in the picture.
Number four in Andrew's section.
Yeah. It's now exposed. It has been, it has melted, and you can see a lot more details. It's not covered by ice anymore.
Do we have any more recent images?
I found that when I traced Admiral Byrd's flight, we had a 1930s animation of his flight path. And then I followed it on Google Earth, and I came across these areas they named really, really strange names. People might go back a couple of years to the Antarctica programs that we did with the discovery of Turtle Cave, which we'll discuss later. But this is
the Asgard Ridge.
Yes, and Executive Committee Mountains.
How about the Rockefeller Mountains?
Yeah, you know, there's... there's an area down there that's called Rothschild Land. And off the coast of Rothschild Land, there seems to be a lot of underwater structures, like domes underwater. Mm-hmm. Really weird stuff is in Antarctica.
Good grief, Andrew.
As a matter of fact.
Let me do a couple of housekeeping things.
Go ahead.
Keith, are you there? Mr. Morgan, are you there? I do not hear Keith.
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay. I put an image that's going to be important.
I'm working on it.
Oh, okay. Just let me know. All right.
Yeah.
So let me go back to Andrew. I'm looking at your number three, not blown up, but like on the screen. Oh, it's astonishing. The symmetry that you saw that I see is just, that's not an asteroid.
No.
No, it's something. I don't think it's a ship either because of the mass and the density. I think what they did is they put shells around asteroids for resources. But the difference is we didn't hit Didymos, we hit Dimorphos, and its density comes out as a ship.
You know what?
Go ahead.
I'm studying this this web of streamers, like these. There's archways.
Yes.
There's archways.
All right, everybody, go to number four and just blow it up big screen. Don't look at this on a phone. Look at it on a computer. Look at all that structural three-dimensional. And you got straight lines. You got right angles. You got three-dimensional right angles, meaning it's cubical, and you're looking at a 3D layering. It's not just straight vorticity.
No.
And it's not individual fragments either. It's chunks of it. No,
well, it's something that will scatter light, and that's usually small stuff in terms of sunlight. You're not going to see big stuff. You're going to see the tiny stuff. But there's such geometry.
Yeah.
And
Jonathan Womack had a post last time, and it looked like a crater. Zoomed in on it, and then you could see all of this.
Yeah, by the way, John was supposed
inside.
To. I just remember John was supposed to be with us tonight. Why isn't he called in? Since my memory is failing, can you try to find Womack and get him in the conversation?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I was saying that that was a graphic from the Oblivion movie, and you couldn't tell it, but it looked like an. It looks like a crater until you zoom in, and then you see all of the structure
made
up the stadium that it was.
Yep.
And same thing's going on here with this Didymos. Yeah.
You know, Robert, the more I look at your Didymos color, you know, pay attention to the color. Look at how symmetrical the blue shell is.
And look how
it's opposite the detonation. Hang on. Look at the straight edge geometry of Didymos. All right. Look at the straight edge geometry of the overexposed explosion of the center of Dimorphos. And the fact that the blue arc is exactly aligned opposite the explosion point.
Yes.
I think that's telling us something about shielding and energy transmitted through object Didymos as opposed to around it, because Didymos is kind of like it provides a shadow blast area where there's like a safe zone behind it.
Yeah, similar to your theory about the shell around the moon.
It may be and it may not. I don't know. I'm just, to me, blue in indicates high energy ionization. So what would be ionized in the shadow away from the explosion? Does it have to do with how something reacts when it's receiving some energy, but not overwhelming energy that makes it visible when it's normally invisible?
How about an artificial atmosphere or a magnetic field around it?
I would say field, but I wouldn't say magnetic, and certainly wouldn't be atmosphere, because you'd see evidence of an atmosphere, unless the atmosphere is caused by what's happening on the Dimorphos side being transmitted through, and all the air is being expelled.
Exudite.
Exactly. It's being, it's like blowing up a balloon. You're seeing the shock wave of the expanding gases escaping, and they're escaping almost spherically as opposed to like the material objects that we're seeing as part of a three-dimensional, weird geometric. Look at all that geometry.
Richard, it's not just that. I'm going to say this. There is a peculiar repeating, like, archway design.
See, this
here.
Is why if we this... need your sketching, so the mouse will have to wait.
Oh, boy.
But, yeah, I mean, to me.
Richard,
Go ahead. What?
Oh, no, I'm just telling you, don't get Andrew fired.
They can't fire
fired
him.
Up or
they,
fired.
They need him.
Okay.
You know.
Well, I know. Well, he happens to be very, very good at what he does, which is always a good thing
and
for job
And he's the only
security.
Guy in the damn but, solar system who can do this.
Well, not sure about that. But.
Yeah.
By the way,
a rhetorical question. If you rotate one magnetic field inside another, what happens?
You get electricity. You get a voltage. You get a current.
Yes. Well, Didymos rotates. It rotates on its own, you know, relative to the rest of the solar system.
Every it used to rotate by
two,
the way.
2 hours.
No.
A little over 2 hours.
2.26 hours. 2 hours and 20 minutes, give or take. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, what was really weird is they've had 3 weeks of data collection. This is a NASA team. They did not mention, and I'm trying to get, you know, my astronomer types, the citizen scientist types I'm working with, I'm trying to get them to measure it. And they're kind of bored with everything. They think it's all, you know, the story's over, which is how people can be lulled to sleep. They can see something amazing right in front of them and have no idea what they're looking at. I want them to measure the rotational period of Didymos because it should still be in the vicinity of 2.26 hours, and it's not. Nowhere did NASA, with all their incredibly, incredibly sensitive telescopes all over the world, like 13 or more major observatories all over the planet, not one of them reported the rotational period of Didymos.
15's up and Jonathan's here.
Excellent. Oh, nice. John.
Excellent.
Jonathan,
hi, Richard.
Welcome to the party. We need to raise your volume. You need to raise your volume, okay?
Okay.
I can do something. All right. I'm raising. I don't want to get you too out of level with the other folks, okay? And I'm refreshing my page, and there is my number 15. Thank you, Keith. Beautiful. Okay, so, John, go look at item number 8. I'm sorry, item number 4. My item number 4.
Yes.
What do you see around Dimorphos and Didymos in the upper right-hand corner? The explosion. The aftermath of the explosion.
Yeah.
What do you see, and have you heard any of our conversation?
I just tuned in at the last break. So for the to catch the last hour, I just finished my taxes.
Congratulations. Okay. Andrew and I are the wing nuts that see incredible three-dimensional geometry.
Looks like architecture.
Yes. Three-dimensional,
Gothic.
Blown
Gothic.
Up.
Gothic.
Yeah. Well, it looks very Arches Park, you know.
Yeah. I think we're looking at the guts of Dimorphos splayed out by the explosion, like the inflation model of the universe by what's his name, Goot or Guthrie, I forget his physicist. They came up with the inflation model where everything expands at super velocity, but it all stays together in the same geometry. That's what I'm seeing. It's like someone took a magnifier and simply magnified the very tiny, because on this scale, if Didymos is half a mile across, then Dimorphos, which is in the center of the bright expanse to the upper 11 o'clock position, would be one-fifth of that. So this is like an instantaneous expansion of the geometry inside this ancient, in the model, spaceship.
Richard, there's this wonderful little art and knickknacks, shop near my home. And one of the things that this fellow sells are these beautiful cards that are intricately cut sculptures. Like when you open them up, they turn into a 3D model of these beautiful, intricate, spindly, paper that just all – this is what this reminds me of. It's just like this is incredible.
Wow. Okay, guys, we're at the bottom of the hour. We've got to hold it there. Okay. Everyone pause, take a deep breath. I know we're talking about some really far out stuff tonight, but space is far out. Hidden history is far out. A space agency which does weird things and never tells its people what it's really doing, that's far out. There's nothing simple or mundane about any of this. And again, if you want to join us, 917-889, let's see, I have to actually get the thing up here because I can't do it from memory. 917-889-8802. you can join the conversation if you've got a bright idea, or you have something you want to contribute, or you think we're totally nuts. All opinions are treated equally until we have total definitive proof. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment for your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone. Last half hour to go here on the other side of midnight. If you want to join the conversation, and we've got someone calling in from area code 804. So given the fact that I invited you, let me click on the right icon, and you're on the air. Sign in, please.
Oh, hi, Richard. Barb Honegger. How are you?
Oh, Barbara. It's Barbara Honegger. You're not supposed to get
listen,
more.
You're
not supposed to give away our secret yet. Don't give away our secret.
No,
okay?
I'm not going to give away any secrets. I just want to point out an amazing synchronicity, which may be important and maybe not, and then I'll get off the phone. And that is in number 14, I believe, let's see, is that, it looks like that's your item, number 14. You open it up, it says the web image of the Didymos post-impact, okay?
Yeah, 14 I was just about to get to because it's a stunning comparison.
Well, let me point out, you mentioned Operation Starfish. That looks like a starfish to me.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to get off the phone. You talk about it, okay.
Okay. Actually, a very interesting segue, Barbara. If everybody goes to my item number 14, click on that. This is a side comparison of a nebula, a planetary nebula, which is, I forget how many thousand light years away, photographed by Hubble a couple, 3 years ago. And on the right is a negative image of the first few hours of the Didymos Dimorphos explosion from the Webb Space Telescope. Now, we're all familiar with the diffraction spikes around the web. There are six of them. You can see those. The important thing is what's in the middle and how it appears to be cone-shaped up and cone-shaped down, very similar when you click on the red rectangle and make it bigger to the geometry of that extraordinary planetary nebula, which is really confounding all the theorists. You have these extraordinary geometries around planetary nebula, and none of the mainstream guys can figure out how in a vacuum where things move as spheres and spirals and all that, do you get this extraordinary geometry. And when you look at the details, there is such an intriguing comparison because what I think is governing the shapes of these celestial objects in the galaxy, which are twins, they're double stars whirling around each other very, very tightly, very ancient stars, white dwarfs and maybe red dwarfs or maybe a main sequence star at the low end of the main sequence. Material is shared between one star and the other, and the orbital period and inclination of the orbit changes. In other words, the angular momentum is transferred from one star to the other, which in De Palma's laboratory experiments and Nikolai Kozarev's equivalent experiments in the old Soviet Union is how you tap in to the torsion field energy and release extraordinary amounts of hyperdimensional physics. I think what we're seeing on incredibly different scales is a natural event in the galaxy doing it somewhere 1,000 light years away that was caught by Hubble many years ago and by other telescopes long before, but this is the best resolution data that we ever got. And then if you look to the right, to the negative image of Webb, we're seeing in those first few hours, now we're far beyond the scale of the previous image with that geometry that Andrew and Ron and Robert and I were talking about. We're now looking at something that's hundreds of miles across. And then, of course, as it gets bigger and bigger, it shows us another geometry on an even bigger scale of thousands of miles, which is where we get the outlines of number 13, an inner and an outer tetrahedral morphology with not enough dust to fill in the outer part, all of the geometric form that is clustering around the inner system and is being moved around by solar radiation pressure. So yeah, that is not an accidental comparison. And again, who knows what the guys who were banging off the nuclear weapons over the South Pacific in the early 60s knew about what nuclear weapons really are tapping into. And Joseph Farrell and I have had these discussions where some of these tests very much underperformed and other nuclear tests overwhelmingly overperformed. And Joseph and I think that the missing component is that if you do a nuclear test on the wrong day, you don't get much of an effect. If you do it on the right day, you get a huge effect because you're not just looking at thermonuclear fission or fusion, fusion of a thermonuclear weapon or fission of a ordinary atomic bomb, but you're doing something that literally is opening doors between dimensions and gating other energy through, which is exactly what seems to have happened with the Didymos-Dimorphos collision of the DART spacecraft 3 weeks ago. The floor is open.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Did you hear me?
A detail with the package is that hasn't come up yet is that Didymos, which is just sitting there, poor thing, hopefully it's still okay, it is basically unique in shape. You know, it looks like a perfectly reasonable shape for something to be, but it's the only one we have in the catalogs that's exactly like that. It's so pristine and so perfect.
Because I think it was deliberately set up as the time capsule, so they chose the best surviving thing that we could then figure out the rest of the history by the very objects that were carrying the message.
It's definitely as pretty as the Pompidou Center or you know, or the Disney building in Hollywood or something. It's
okay, Robert, it's time to segue to the Antarctic. So start out with the unseen, mysterious Russian expedition.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, I wanted to do two plugs, one for Andrew and one for me. Andrew and our friend Leanne Jones have just put out a book illustrated by Andrew Curry. It's called Mr. Bratchuk's Marvelous Motor. It's about a Canadian inventor who invented a perpetual motion motor that ran on air. And I recommend it to everyone. The illustrations are fantastic. And Andrew even put his son in there. I think you got to pay him. Secondly, tomorrow is my birthday.
Aww.
And for celebrating a birthday party on the air with George Noory on Coast to Coast AM. They invited me for that day. So if you can stay up till 3 a.m. in the morning, you can join us. But I am going to be talking really straight talk about the UFO cover-up and the decision of the United States government to make a deal with aliens in 1947, as recommended by Albert Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer. And I'm going to lift the veil on this whole thing with George Noory, 3 a.m. tomorrow, October 18th. And I may even sing happy birthday to...
Are they coming to take you away?
Yeah, that's my escort. No, I may even sing happy birthday to a man who richly deserves one, and that would be Lee Harvey Oswald, who was born on October 18th, 1939. Oh. Yeah, what a coincidence. That's how I know he was innocent. A Libra could never do such a thing. But anyway, let's go. I asked the audience to turn on the video that we provided. It's under Andrew's items. And if you run a video, it's just silently. You don't have to listen to the narration and just study the pictures. Richard and I had a conversation about it earlier this week. So I'd like to read from my email in response to Richard, because this is the key to it. And also, I want to thank Barbara Honecker for calling in about the starfish, because this is also very significant. I think we're experiencing a psychic resonance right now amongst all of us, because weeks ago, Andrew sent me a beautiful photograph of a starfish that he encountered and had to wade into the water to take a picture.
Oh, yes, that was really amazing.
So this image and this message is in the air. And I'll give you the kicker later when I talk about the thing. And regarding these photographs in this video, I wrote to Richard, I've seen almost all of those photos many times before. Most of them were discovered over the past decade on Google Earth by independent researchers. There is a photograph of a half disc inside a cave. And I've seen that one before as well. From the mountain that shows the structure years ago as quote-unquote Turtle Cave, which I prefer to call Nazi Helmet Cave, because it looks like that chamber pot helmet that the Nazis wore in World War II.
Is that the one with that huge door that's kind of partway open?
Well, it's a cavern with a helmet over the entrance like an awning. It's on the website. If people go back to The Other Side of Midnight a couple of years ago where we did Antarctica.
Oh, yeah, they can easily do that. No, don't do that now. Do it later.
No, not now. Later. You can find it easily by typing in Ra Bird, R-A-B-Y-R-D. It's something I named a crater that's on the same mountain that apparently nobody sees it. It's either an extinct volcano or the site of a meteor impact that melted ice and left the crater 1,700 feet in diameter. So I've also seen the photos of the air spacecraft that's being transported openly on U.S. highways. The blue one was photographed in Arizona on Highway 10. I remember seeing the flying saucer being transported uncovered as it was shown on CNN after a bunch of people took videos of it on the public highway. I recall it was in California near Palo Alto, not Arizona. The blue space plane looks like a drone, and that was shown in Arizona. Obviously, they were intentional leaks to give the public a peekaboo view of military intelligence secret projects.
Yeah, it's kind of like Bob Haldeman and his limited hangout to Nixon. If they show us something really exotic, they can then say, oh, UFOs are just our secret stuff.
Exactly, especially the flying saucer, which would be an attempt at a soft debunking of UFO reality by hinting or suggesting that the UFOs that people are seeing...
But this was many years ago. This was like 10 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years ago, and it was there. It's plain as day. As a matter of fact, let me reminisce. One day I was going out to fly at MacArthur Airport, and I was on the Long Island.
We have 15 minutes in the show left.
Okay, it's very short. I was going on the Long Island Expressway heading to MacArthur Airport to take a plane up and do some flying on the East Coast here. And I looked down the highway, and about 3 miles away, I saw a flashing light. I saw a tractor trailer. And I saw a flying saucer flying over the highway at about 30 feet above the ground. And as it came closer, and I was doing 60, 70 miles an hour that way, and they were doing 50 the other way. And what they were carrying was one of the raid domes from German aircraft that's shaped like a flying saucer. Mm, so it was really quite an interesting thing. So this object was similar.
Wait, you don't mean one of those spinning things from the AWACS?
Exactly.
AWACS. Those are not Grumman. That's a Boeing 707s with the big rotating antenna.
Well, the airplane is Boeing, but the raid dome was made by Grumman.
Okay.
We go on. Obviously, intentional leak, peekaboo, to suggest that what we're seeing in the skies is our secret programs. Of course, that's bunk, not debunk. The only ones that I had not seen were those about the mountain ranges discovered by the Russians under the ice. So the images are authentic, although I cannot verify the Russian photos of the 3,000-meter high mountain range since I'm seeing those for the first time. Now about the starfish. The thing, is something that has to do with life forms in Antarctica. The Thing was based on a book or a story.
Oh, you mean the movie, the Thing.
The movie, The Thing, yeah.
The famous Howard Hawks 1950s movie that was set in the Arctic as opposed to the Antarctic, and they have this huge flying saucer buried in the ice, and The Thing is the pilot inside who survived.
Yeah, James Arness.
Yes.
His first big role. Well, I have to say that having read In the Mountains of Madness, the interesting thing, this is what The Thing is based on, except they transposed it to the Arctic. It's actually in Antarctica. And The Thing that...
Well, you know why, right?
Well, tell me.
They didn't dare focus it on the Antarctic because of all the stuff that's there.
Of course. They wanted to deflect attention to the opposite side.
Yep, opposite side of the planet.
But here's the point. The creature that starts to gobble up the scientists.
The plant being.
No, yeah, he's a plant being up in Antarctica in The Thing, but in The Mountains of Madness, it is a starfish-shaped creature that's been down there for millions of years. And these scientists come down and go into the cave, and the starfish creature starts gobbling them up.
You know why starfish are interesting, don't you?
Well, tell me. I know a lot of reasons, but let me hear.
They regenerate. You take off an arm, and they grow it back perfectly.
Exactly, and that's what the creature in The Thing did in the Antarctic. Remember, they cut off his arm.
Yep.
And he regrew an arm, and then they feed blood to the severed arm and start.
And
you mean
the Howard Hawks movie? Yeah.
Yeah, the Howard Hawks movie. The other thing I remember about that movie is
in the beginning, the
reporter says, this thing could have come from Mars.
Yep.
And when I saw that the first time, Mars was a dot 50 million miles away, and never in my wildest dreams as a child would I have thought that we would be exploring the surface of Mars ourselves. We have come so far in 70 years.
Yeah, but they've kept it all secret.
Yeah, well, we're the ones that are giving the secrets out.
Provided this damn show continues, I'm telling you, we're right on the edge, folks. We need help.
Yep.
We really need help, and I've never done this before, but we're right up against the edge, and I don't want to scare people, but we need to be a voice, you know, as this all comes tumbling out of Fibber McGee's closet.
Yeah. Two more. Before we run out of time, I want to finish.
Check real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. The stuff coming out of the ice... You can see that these are tree trunks or whatever, and you've got the over under weaving of rope or cable or whatever. And then there's something, cables going down on the ground that make a right angle turn and go up on the side, the left side. Obviously, that's not natural.
Wait, you're talking about the picture in number 4, right, in Andrew's section?
But the one in the video.
Oh, I don't have the video up. I just have the still.
Yeah, we can't cue it up. But we can discuss that later. But I want to say this. The reason for Operation High Jump was that in 1946, the British sent a special operation down there, Special Air Services, to explore Antarctica. And they ran into some giant humanoids who were really, really terribly destructive and wiped out most of the British Special Operations Special Air Services crew. I believe that that was what was the reason why Operation High Jump was mounted. Now, going back to 1932, I mentioned that Stalin had sent a Soviet expedition down to Antarctica, and they were searching for uranium. They went back to Moscow, and they reported to Stalin that they had run into a race of 12-foot-tall, copper-skinned, copper-colored giant men who did not speak but communicated telepathically, and that they were assisted by short little gray beings. And the Russians told them that they were on a peaceful mission there looking for uranium. And the tall, 12-foot-tall, bronze-skinned men told them, no go, you can't come in here. So these stories do line up. The giant...
But wait, don't you think that the Stalin story is a cover story? Because everybody in anybody's knowledge knows what the real stuff is. It's just us great unwashed that don't know. It was a perfect time to say, oh, we're looking for uranium, when they're really looking for ancient artifacts from either an earlier human incredible civilization or aliens.
Well, maybe that's a cover story for the purpose of the mission, but we know that the Soviet scientists were just as smart as the Germans and the Americans.
Of course they were.
We had a technological edge as far as industry and manufacturing. So everyone was looking for uranium, but that's not the important part. The part is that running into this race of 12-foot-tall, bronze-skinned humanoids, they didn't say aliens, humanoids, reminds me an awful lot of the whole Anunnaki legends, that they were gigantic beings. And perhaps that is where they retreated or have had their base throughout these epochs and operating from Antarctica. Remember, Admiral Byrd said that in the future war, we would have to fight against aircraft that were capable of flying from pole to pole.
Remember what Douglas MacArthur said at West Point. The next war will be interplanetary.
And we
It's on the record.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, I saw that speech to the Long Gray Line, his farewell speech. It was amazing. In those days, they would broadcast everything live, and I was lucky enough to
see. Well, they didn't have tape. That's why they had to do it live. You know,
Robert?
Yeah.
And Richard, point of order, what were people doing looking for uranium in 1932?
Because we knew it would be the energy source. They just didn't know how to do it.
They could have gotten it in Arkansas. They didn't have to go to the Antarctica for something that was only used for watch dials.
No, that was radium. That was radium.
Well, I know. Yeah.
Ron, the Russians, the Soviets would not be allowed into Arkansas to mine for uranium.
They have Afghanistan and Korea. Korea has the largest deposits of uranium that we know of. That's why North Korea and South Korea have a line between them, because all the mineral stuff is up in the
We're running out of time.
North
Ron,
Korea.
Ron,
yeah,
Ron.
I know. I didn't
point,
mean to go
point
derail
taken,
it.
Point
that
taken.
Way.
Okay, keep going,
yeah.
Robert. Keep going.
Yeah, I just said when I hear giants, I want authentication. That's all.
Well, it's in the Smithsonian archives. They've just there were giants. Our ancestors were giants. There's artifacts all over the solar system that are evidence of giant structures like on the moon. So yes, giants living temporarily, not permanently, unless they have fields and anti-gravity, are perfectly within the model.
Well, you know, the Bible mentions that they measured the bed of the last giant in history, and his bed was 13 feet in length. And of course, we have David and Goliath. So I think that they were the remnant of an Anunnaki hybrid race of the Nephilim. So I don't think it's out of possibility that they may have retreated to Antarctica and have been operating there since time immemorial.
Well, the book Forbidden Archaeology by Thompson and I forget Michael Cremo documents all the evidence of giant skeletons that the Smithsonian scarfed up and stashed away. So no, this is not even controversial. There used to be giants in the earth, and nobody wants us to know about it.
Right.
12 feet, I'll go for 20 feet, no. That's
yeah.
All.
Well, there's another problem, and it has to do with gravity, and that's changing physics. So keep going, Robert. We got 4 minutes.
I know a U.S. Marine I know a U.S. Marine very well, and he told me that when he was in Afghanistan, they had a firefight and they killed an 18-foot-tall giant. They killed a couple of Marines by ripping their heads off and ripping their arms right out of their bodies. And that when they had to, when they finally brought him down, they had to transport him under a payload helicopter on a pallet because the thing was so big.
The mass.
And of course,
sheer mass. Yes.
Sure. Yeah. So, and remember, in 2012 or so, during the Barack Obama administration, everyone was going to Afghanistan. Let me see. John Kerry went down there. A couple of other.
You mean the Antarctic?
No, no, just Afghanistan. Regarding the giants and something that was found mm-hmm. there. He found a cave that seemed to have something that created time anomalies. And there's a movie all of you need to see. It's called The Objective. And it's precisely about a CIA operation run into Afghanistan to find a secret site. In the end, it turns out they found in Afghanistan a nest for UFOs, and that the CIA was sacrificing this group of soldiers to get to the nest. It's a fantastic movie. It's called The Objective. It's really well made, but the thing that shocked me was when the titles ran at the end, it was co-produced and co-written by Wesley Clark Jr.
Oh,
and I
really?
Said to myself, yeah, and I said to myself, my God, did Daddy tell him this story and him write it up? Now, the interesting thing is if you see The Objective now, they don't show you the titles. Because I made a big deal about that. I wrote, hey, this is a serious movie.
Okay, we got 1 minute.
Okay, that's yours. I'm finished.
Okay, if you want to see the reality of ancient artifacts of the South Pole, look at my number 15, the story of I did it. We've talked about it in previous shows. We have someone who is looking for the original bird footage to get much better data, but there's obvious, incredible geometric artificial things in the mountains of madness in the Antarctic. And I think that our science fiction friend somehow knew this. The reason they transposed the thing. Thank you. They transposed the thing from the Antarctic to the Arctic is so they would keep attention away. And I'm kind of running out of time. So I want to thank all my guests, Robert Morningstar and Andrew Curry and Keith Morgan and Ron Gerbron and Barbara Honecker for her brief look in. Yeah, Barbara and I are working on a little surprise that will come to fruition in the next few days, actually maybe a week or two. So until then, until next weekend, more surprises. You've been on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return next week. Say goodnight, everyone, and remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night.